Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to talk about infrastructure. Yes, our governor has the word transportation. It flowed off his tongue. Granted, no plan yet. Some speculation. We're going to talk about that. But it's coming. Something's coming. Don't know what, but something. I guess it's a step towards the right direction. Also going to talk about the striking school bus drivers in New York City, what's going on there. Gerrymandering and the impending theft of the 2016 presidential election. We're going to talk about guns and God, outsourcing and porn, CEOs destroying Social Security, and the GOP burning down the House. That and so much more. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So no big surprise. Today the governor announced, yeah, gonna go forward with the lottery privatization scheme. And you gotta give him credit. A little patience. You know, last Friday they announced that they were going to give the company the lottery and sign the deal. The ink was dry. Then they held their first hearing. First hearing? Okay, we're gonna have a hearing on it. It was a kangaroo sham of a hearing. I remember several of the Democratic senators going, well, I promised we wouldn't get into a debate here. I'm going, this is exactly where you need to debate. And you had a Republican, Pat Vance, who didn't want to get into the technicalities. And they go, well, isn't this what this is for? It was a nice staged presentation. It did what it was supposed to do. It got the message out that senior programs are going to need help. We've got more people retiring. We have done a poor job in the last 30 years of planning for that because we have a political system that says to politicians, I can get reelected by thinking tip of the nose, by not having visions for the future, by not planning for the future, but just tip of the nose stuff. And we've reinforced that as voters. So when they should have been saying, hey, you know, we need a couple of pennies extra here or there so that we can invest in these different things and make sure that they go to those different things, we threw those folks out. And in came the tax cuts, not, without asking what we're actually cutting. And you look at, you know, Bush in 2000, promised all the world of tax cuts, brought in a world of tax cuts, although you and I didn't share in much of it. We got a couple of prizes, a couple of Bush prizes came in the mail. And he was sure to tell us that they were coming. But overall, you and I, the crumbs we got didn't match what flowed heavily to the top, which not only was resource, but, you know, resource that could have gone to education or the infrastructural problems that we've got now or any of that. It was that surplus that was going to pay our debt completely off, and we were going to be a debt-free nation. And I think that's important to remember, especially as we keep looking at these crises that the Republicans keep leading us towards. Always to the cliff, always to the edge, always the ticking bomb down to the final second before, oh, magically, some solution. And, you know, the next solution going to be a short-term one so that they can do it again. You got to remember, 2000. I do. We were going to be debt-free. Alan Greenspan opined that he had no idea what this nation would look like debt-free. And yet here we are, just 13 years later, $16.4 trillion in debt. You go, how'd that happen? We were going to be debt-free. We had surpluses as far as the eye could see. Well, we gave the surplus away. And then we had a couple of wars that we didn't think we needed to pay for. And then we had a prescription drug plan that we didn't think, well, we didn't want competition because, you know, the right wing believes in competition. Well, never mind that. Competition for you and me, beating each other up in the street, but not for the drug companies. No, not that. So I think it's the only thing in the country that we say, no, we'll pay you retail. Charge us whatever you want. We'll pay it. Don't worry. Got to make sure those profits are okay. So now what we've got is we've got these problems, and we do have some problems that need to be addressed. So our governor has come out and said, look, we're going to look at, we're privatizing it all. This is going to be the year of the privatization. Everything's going to go. The lottery today, the wine and spirit shops tomorrow, you name it, it's going. And as I was sitting here before coming on the air, I was thinking, you know, Obama's slogan for his campaign was forward. Just the other day, Harrisburg Mayor Linda Thompson laid out her slogan, onward. Well, I've already got Transparency Tom's slogan for his 2014, backward, because that's where we're going. We're going back to the good old days, the 80s and the 90s, the 1880s and 1890s, where the handful, they controlled everything. And nothing was really ours. Nothing was really we the people's. Nothing. And the working class, you were just that. And we had better really wake up. Because all of these privatization schemes are coming full tilt. And with this idea that if it screws the workers, all right. If we can make it look like, if we can manipulate things to make it look like it's a good deal, all right. If it's a sweetheart deal for corporations and corporate special interests, even better. And if it lines the campaign coffers, sold. Done. Out the door. Don't care what it actually does, because we do know all of these privatization schemes, top to bottom, I've yet to find one that hasn't followed this mode. The workers get cheated right away. They get thrown out of decent pay, benefits, you know, health care, pension, that's done. They end up working for a company that, over time, the wages continue to go down. Continue to go down, benefits are eviscerated, all that's gone, and now you've got desperation class jobs. And trust me, the lottery workers right now, the people who are working, those jobs, same thing. You're going to see them fall. And what does that mean? Well, it means people aren't going to be paying as much in tax revenue. So we're going to, it's that spiral thing I keep talking about. If you don't have revenue coming in, you can't afford to pay for senior programs or for education or for roads and bridges or any of this stuff. And then you have more of this austerity. It's a spiraling down. And you look at the manipulation, and I look at this lottery deal, and it is riddled with holes. And I love the fact that they released the letters from the other two companies who said, well, it was too lopsided to the state. Yeah, because they wanted an even bigger sweetheart deal. The fact that there's some upfront money, boy, that just blew it out of the water. What? You're going to actually hold us? Like, no. I mean, you look at this, and I ask the question, what happens? What happens if nobody buys a lottery ticket next year? Say the economy triple votes, say the tanks, because we continue to follow this austerity. Are we going to get $1 billion from Camelot Global? The answer is no. Not even close. And we've been through this time and time again. And we're going to go back to last year when the legislature didn't have the votes to pass the privatization of the wine and spirit shops. It's going to be back. Because it's the ideology. It's their blind faith belief. And back again, we're going to have these conversations about the wine and spirit shops. And fine, bring it on, because I think we need to have these privatization conversations often. And really highlight, who is it that benefits from this? Let's say we do privatize the wine and spirit shops. What happens to those stores? What happens to that? Well, those go away because the state's not operating them anymore. And, you know, they keep telling us, well, at the beginning of that last argument, well, mom and pops will be able to buy the licenses. No, they're not. They're not going to be able to afford what they were saying they wanted for them, which was like upwards of $1 million. But we know from New Jersey, they get like $50,000 for a license. That's a whole other argument. What we know is we're going to lose 5,000 workers. They're going to be gone. Done. This argument that somehow we're going to open up all of these little wine and spirit shops is not going to happen. What it's going to be is it's going to be the popular brands. They're going to end up on a store shelf somewhere. They're going to end up at, you know, like where I grew up in Cleveland. They're going to end up on the 7-Eleven shelf or the mini mart shelf down at the bottom at the back. They're going to end up on the grocery store shelf or the big box retail shelf. And it's just going to be another impulse item. They go, oh, hey, yeah, let's grab one of those. So it's going to happen. There are no jobs associated with it. It's only job loss. And the jobs that may be created, because you're going to need someone to stock the shelves occasionally, are going to be minimum wage retail jobs. So instead of having decent wage jobs that pay, have a little bit of benefit, a little health care, a little pension, now you're talking about desperation nation. So again, I think the proper slogan for the Corbett administration as they look towards their re-election campaign is backward. Because everything that they're doing seems to me to be very backwards for you and me. The campaign donors, they're thrilled. But working people, not so much. And the question is how much of this are we going to put up with? Because you know, what's really opened my eyes is how well the right has, the wealth and the business class, how well they have over misinformed average voters. Most people you talk to, it seems like a good idea. Yeah, why not? You know, but privatize it without thinking that we're going to lose the state's going to lose the revenue. We're going to lose the tax, the 1% tax that we get paid to us through the law. We're going to lose the jobs and all of the tax revenue that goes along with that. And you're going to lose the control, the societal control to really try and cut down on the negative things. And I've said this before. When I was 15, I was buying whatever I wanted from the local stores because it was a consumer good. It was just something to push. The more we can sell, the better. And like I talked about yesterday, you know, if you want to privatize something and you really want to try and get the, you know, to think it through, things that are concrete, things that are, you know, are measurable. Okay, you're going to rebuild this road. Okay, the road is, this is what you're going to do. These are the specs. This is what has to, okay, I can see you wanting to do that. Maybe you're going to do a little bit better. Maybe you're going to do it a little faster because you've got larger volume. Whatever the rationale is. But when you're talking about a consumer good like wine and spirits or lottery tickets or whatever, there's a lot of societal problems that the private corporation's not going to have to address. There's a lot of wiggling around with the profit margins, wiggling around with the labor margins. It's a screw job. This is a ripoff. And yet our governor has just said, yep, going through with the lottery. And going to push for those wine and spirit shops. Be prepared. It's coming. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla. Stick around. Right back after this.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. I'm an announcer winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Teaching America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 8,000 school bus drivers, members of Amalgamated Transit Local 1181, are on strike in New York City. Amalgamated Transit Union International President Larry Hanley.
We are the common victims of a mayor who is a billionaire and completely out of touch and out of control. He has picked this fight, staged it, brought it about on his calendar, not on any other schedule. He has an open fight with every worker who is employed by him right now in the city. He is refusing to negotiate contracts with cops and firemen and sanitation workers and teachers. The people are the victims, and they should stand with us and tell this mayor to just cut it out and start being a mayor and stop being a billionaire.
The union says after 50 years of job protections and wage stability for school bus drivers, Mayor Bloomberg arbitrarily threw that out by putting school bus contracts up for bids among private companies. That means the workers could suddenly lose their jobs or have their wages and benefits lowered. The ATU tried to avert a strike over the issue, but Hanley says Bloomberg won't even talk to the union. Hanley says ATU school bus drivers are committed to getting school children safely to and from school. He says safety is enhanced by job and wage stability among drivers because qualified, experienced drivers stay on the job longer. Hanley says the people of New York and the union bus drivers are victims of a right-wing attack on working people.
This is Wisconsin and Michigan having come to New York City. It is a mayor who is on the same right-wing agenda, although sometimes he hides it, that Scott Walker has been on in Wisconsin. This is the right-wing Tea Party attack on working people, and people in this country really need to take stock of what's happening and stand up with organized labor in New York as they have stood with organized labor around the country.
French auto workers near Paris have occupied a plant to protest layoffs. Jesse Russell reports.
Peugeot Citroën workers near Paris have occupied a plant in protest of planned layoffs. The company is in the process of laying off 8,000 workers and closing that plant. According to a union representing the workers, nearly 300 have stopped production at the plant, bringing work practically to a standstill. There are roughly 3,000 employees at the plant, but the majority of the striking workers are on the production line. Europe hasn't shared in North America's rebound of the auto industry. The European Union saw new car registrations drop by 16% at the end of 2012. The union has been seeking early retirement offers for the workers who are over the age of 55. But so far, the company has been unwilling to offer such incentives. Peugeot's competitor, Renault, is also planning layoffs, but they're doing so by offering early retirement plans and not bringing on new hires.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If this was done under Rendell's administration, the GOP would be jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin. I just want to make that point. I mean, the Republicans would be going nuts.
Completely disconnected, and you look at the reality. The thing that infuriates me the most is the way they went about this. And if you didn't hear the news, Corbett has said today, yep, going to go forward. Yeah, had your little kangaroo hearing, had the little show, the song and dance, pulled out the ponies and did the little dressage. Still going forward. And I said the other day, look, they did their little thing. They're going to go forward with it anyway. And now there's some voices out there saying, well, now that Kathleen Kane has been sworn in, maybe she's going to stop it. And, well, we shall see if this gamble on our lottery the Corbett administration is undertaking can be stopped, which is why I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla to come talk to us. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So I look at this, and I guess my first argument is the backdoor way in which they went through this.
Well, yeah, I mean, I described it as being akin to the midnight pay raise from years back. They waited till the legislature left for Christmas recess, announced that they were going to do it, even though there had been, you know, they had indicated they might be interested in it. And 2 days or 3 days before the legislature came back, announced that they had signed the agreement. No possibility of legislative oversight. You couldn't have asked for worse timing, although from their standpoint, I guess it saved them a lot of grief. It really was, if you want to, an administration that claims they are transparent, it was about as backdoor midnight deal as you could possibly have gotten.
So I look at this, and Senator Wozniak there at the beginning said, you know, you'd be dancing like Rumpelstiltskin if Rendell had did this. What do you think would have happened had Rendell been a party to something like this?
Well, I mean, I don't think they would have allowed it. Among other things, I still think there's questions about the legality of whether or not they can do what they need to do in order for this to be executed and the dollars that they claim can be generated. They actually need to be expanding gaming in the state of Pennsylvania. And from our perspective, that requires legislative oversight. That requires laws to be changed. And so this claim that they're actually generating more money for seniors is only possible if the legislature approves the expansion of gambling in the state of Pennsylvania. You know, there are a whole lot of legislators on the Republican side that when Governor Rendell actually expanded gaming with all sorts of hearings, I mean, probably more public scrutiny than you could imagine, we're still jumping up and down, screaming that how dare this be done. I've really been surprised that they have sat silent and watched this governor propose to allow a private company to expand gambling in the state of Pennsylvania without any legislative oversight. you know, one, I think it's unconstitutional, but secondly, I'm just amazed at those members that were concerned about the expansion of gambling earlier, years back, when there was plenty of public input, versus this time when it's a backdoor private deal.
So the question then becomes, what are they getting out of it, or is it just team sport politics?
Well, I think part of that is team sport politics, but, you know, what's interesting and was pointed out the other day by my colleague in Philadelphia, Representative Rosita Youngblood, who heads the gaming committee in the state of Pennsylvania on the minority side. You know, unlike the gambling expansion that occurred under the Rendell administration, where none of those gambling establishments are allowed to contribute to legislators or gubernatorial candidates or anyone in the state of Pennsylvania, this deal does not include that. In fact, you know, if you look at it, not only will these people be able to make campaign contributions, which I'm assuming the corporate administration is looking eagerly to get, but it also allows for the consultants in this deal to make a minimum of $30 million for simply putting the deal together.
Wow.
And that's $30 million of taxpayer money that will be going to a consultant who's worked for a couple months for a sweetheart deal.
And the thing that gets, whose brother-in-law is it? Because this, all of this privatization, it's the blind faith ideology of the right. So, I mean, who gets the lucky commission job of doing that? It's their ideology to get rid of everything, and you're going to be the guy who facilitates it, even if it's a bad deal, which I think this is.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, the line is always follow the money. It'll be interesting to follow the money that's already transpired in this deal, but what may be transacted in the future. And I think what we'll see in a very short period of time, if this deal does get done, is that the money will lead you into a lot of really dark places. You know, the other thing is, you know, back during the Ridge administration, there was a situation where there was a contract let for testing of automotive vehicles in the state of Pennsylvania. And when the public had an outcry on that and said this is a raw deal, and the legislature said, yeah, this really doesn't make a whole lot of sense, we had to buy that corporation out. And it was hundreds of millions of dollars to buy out a contract before it ever got started. This deal is very similar in that we have an obligation to buy out this company and pay them off if we don't like the job they're doing. I don't know how you could get into a worse deal than to say, if I like what you're doing, you get to make more money. If I don't like what you're doing, I have to pay you money.
You get to make more money.
Right.
I've been asking about that, because what happens in 3 years, because there's a detanglement period after 3 years, they can just, okay, go. What happens once all of the infrastructure that we have now built, which according to them and the Commonwealth, one of the best in the country, what happens once you've dissolved all of that, and as you pointed out, we're going to have to pay them back? I, the taxpayer, I'm going to get stuck with that.
Yeah, it really is one of those deals where it does not make any sense, no matter how you look at it. I mean, that's the part that I think. And when the administration was questioned on it, they said, well, we don't actually know how much it would cost. We just never expect to have to untangle this mess. I think that's being Pollyannish at best, and being actually just, you know,
just
irresponsible,
stupid,
with the taxpayers' dollars at least. You know, this is one of those deals where it doesn't make sense. It's been rushed. And if this administration had shown their ability to have oversight over things, like if they said, you know what, we've figured out how to manage the Marcellus shale industry, we're doing a good job. If they had said, we've figured out how to manage the public welfare, you know, providers, we're doing a good job, they would have built a little trust. But the trust level with this administration is so low. They have at so many times, time after time, on numerous occasions, proven that they are incapable of monitoring and having oversight of the private entities that they've given sweetheart deals to, that I understand why the public is outraged about this deal.
Well, I've asked numerous times, and I've yet to find a privatization scheme that's come up that's benefited the taxpayers. It's benefited me. I found a lot that have benefited, you know, a handful, because you give these sweetheart deals, somebody's making the bank on it. The sad reality is that people like you, me, all my listeners, we're the ones who get screwed in this.
Yeah. Well, and when you look at the way this deal came down, I mean, there were, three or four bidders initially that were interested in this thing. And little bit by little bit, they got pushed out of the deal. I mean, they finally started becoming, coming public with their concerns about when they asked questions, they were told, you're not going to get an answer. Obviously, somebody knew the answer. And there's one lone sole bidder at the end that made the, deadlines that kept shifting and changing and sort of knew what the inside deal was. I mean, this sort of reeks of something smelling bad about this deal from the get-go. And, the fact that the governor continues to push on this and continues to say we're not going to delay on this leads me to believe that there's something that, here's a guy who, how long did he take to prosecute Jerry Sandusky? Because he wanted to make sure he got everything right. Yeah. And in this particular case, it's rushing make sure that it gets done before anybody figures out what's going on.
Yeah, there's something there. And I guess the question is now with Kathleen Kane being sworn in as Attorney General, is there a way for her to stop this? I mean, there's going to have to be an investigation into this, right?
Well, I mean, I would think and I would hope, and I don't want to speak for the, a new Attorney General, but my hope is that they take a long, hard look at this. I mean, the treasurer, Rob McCord, has said, look, there's some concerns about whether or not I can even legally pay this company. I think the legislature is going to take a look at it. There are lawsuits about this. Even if everything proceeds as planned, we're probably looking at a couple years before this can even take place and a whole lot of taxpayer dollars spent trying to investigate what the heck is going on. There's a real simple thing the governor could do. The governor could just say, look, it's time to put the brakes on this. Let's take a step back, look at this, have public input, figure out what's going on, make sure I'm not doing the worst deal ever in the state of Pennsylvania. Instead, he's full speed ahead with a plan that, assuming that he's only going to be here another 2 years, is going to be the legacy that he leaves three or four or five more governors.
Wow. And you look at this, and one of the things that I keep asking is, as a society, because if you listen to the testimony from Camelot and you listen to what they were saying on how they're going to make money, it's getting more people to gamble. It's obviously making it a consumer product that we're going to sell to more people. Is this societally what we need to have and what we want? And who pays for all of the negative outcomes and all of the negative risks that we know are going to come down the road? Same thing with the wine and spirit shops, with the privatization scheme going on there.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, when we said that we were going to allow gaming in the state of Pennsylvania years ago, they said, look, we'd like to set up shop in your state. And we said, okay, how about if you pay a 55% tax? And they said, okay, we'll come. Even though the tax in other states was 3% and 6%. They said, we'll come at 55%. And we've used that to the citizens' benefits. And we also said there had to be dollars in there in case there was gambling addiction. And we also said, oh, we've got to do property tax relief. And we also said, oh, and there's a thousand other things we wanted to do. This is a case where the only people that are benefiting from this are the privateers. The seniors, we're told, are guaranteed some dollars, but if you look at the growth that has occurred in the lottery in the last 40 years in the state of Pennsylvania for the seniors of Pennsylvania, these people aren't guaranteeing as much as we would normally grow in the state of Pennsylvania. And instead, what we're doing is we're giving them the ability as a private company to dictate to the state when and where they're going to do gambling and how they're going to do gambling. And that's something that the legislature has always sort of held sacred as to, but we're going to determine this for the people of Pennsylvania, not have somebody tell us how to do it. This governor said, no, we're going to let some foreign corporation tell us how we're going to do gaming in the state of Pennsylvania.
And expand it massively. I mean, this Keno thing,
right.
this could be everywhere.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the only way Keno operates is if you put it into every bar in the state of Pennsylvania. And, you know, then it's not the kind of oversight that you have in the casinos where there's trained people looking at what's going on. You have a bartender standing behind a bar saying, you want another Keno ticket.
Yeah, you want another shot with that Keno ticket as well.
Right.
You know, and the thing is, I guess the question then becomes, is that what we want? I mean, do we want that pervasive in our society? And I guess the other side is, if the answer is yes, we do want that, why can't we do it ourselves? Why do we need this foreign company to do it?
Well, that's the thing. First off, we've never had the debate as to whether or not we want that. We've always been told we didn't want it. Now we're told we're going to get it whether we want it or not. But again, as you point out, we have the ability to do that ourselves and do it for a lesser price than these people will. Our overhead in the lottery is 2.1% for administrative costs. That is the envy of the world.
Yep.
Camelot, in their other operations, on their own website, say that they do a brilliant job by keeping the administrative costs at 4%. That's twice the cost. Why would we want to pay somebody twice the cost of what it takes us to operate this system?
That doesn't make any sense.
No sense at all.
Have you seen any of the language specific to prizes? Because, you know, I was talking with Dave Philman the other day, executive director of AFSCME Council 13. He says currently the lottery pays out 61% of the dollar that you spend on a lottery ticket back in prizes. And what Camelot pays, what they testified in the hearing, what they pay in the UK is 50 cents. So, you know, in looking at this, there's a lot of variables for them to make a lot of money, you know, shifting things around. Is there anything that says they can't drop that down?
Yeah, I don't, you know, we don't know because we haven't had a chance to look at these contracts. That's the sad part about this. This has all been under the cloak of darkness while no one was around. And now we're supposed to rush to judgment. I mean, the governor continues to put people in a place where the clock is ticking and they have to rush to a judgment on this. This makes absolutely no sense. This is bad business. You wouldn't do this in a normal business setting. You wouldn't do this particularly in a government setting where the public is, you know, trying to have oversight. And this governor has insisted that this is going on. And then what you're going to see while we're trying to deal with this, he's also going to roll out another half a dozen plans to try and basically like overload the plate into hopes that something gets through. I mean, I think this is the governor's new strategy here. He used to run one thing up the flagpole, watch it be shot down because it was such a bad idea. Wait a while, run another thing up the flagpole, watch it be shot down because it was a horrible idea. And now he's decided he's going to run a half a dozen things up the flagpole and surely something will avoid getting hit. And he'll at least be able to claim he got something done.
Yeah, and I see.
Doesn't matter how bad it is, but he'll, you know, something will get done.
I see the wine and spirit shops. He said he's going to go back after that, even though in the last session it was shot down. Everybody I talk to gets it when you explain that, hey, this is an asset that we hold. We're getting tax dollars out of this. It's for the benefit. People wake up and go, whoa, wait a minute. Let's not do this, especially for almost nothing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this governor is famous for trying to sell off the things that work in the state of Pennsylvania and avoiding the things that don't work and basically in some cases making them worse. I mean, he's waited for 2 years to even think about talking about roads and infrastructure in the state of Pennsylvania. He's decimated the school system in the state of Pennsylvania due to $1 billion cuts 2 years running. You know, jobs in the economy, he talks about the fact that there's been 100,000 new jobs created in the state of Pennsylvania while he's been governor. He neglects the fact that there's been more jobs lost than that, and the unemployment rate has actually gone up while he's been governor. You know, so those are the things that he's not concerned about. Instead, the things that are actually working for the people of Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Lottery, the liquor control system, which generates dollars for the citizens of Pennsylvania, the things that have been working, he's been seeking to sell off and get rid of. If there was anyone who's ever tried to dismantle the good things about this state, this is the guy.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said at the beginning, Obama's slogan for the last election was forward, and I see Linda Thompson's slogan is onward. Our governor, I've got one for him, backward, because that's where he's taking us. Mike, it's great talking with you. I appreciate the time, and keep up the fight there.
Thanks.
Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla. Quick break, right back after this. 1-888-520 Rick, 1-888-520-7425.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
In the scramble to fix the federal deficit, one of Washington's worst ideas is widely considered by political elites, including some Democrats, to be a good idea, even a painless fix. The idea is to raise the age of eligibility for both Social Security and Medicare, shoving it from 65 to 67 or beyond. After all, goes Washington's conventional wisdom, people live so much longer now, so it won't hurt to postpone eligibility and save a couple of years of taxpayer outlays to people. But, as economist and columnist Paul Krugman has pointed out, this bit of conventional wisdom is merely conventional, in the sense of trite. While life expectancy has gone up on average, it has not increased much for working stiffs, especially tens of millions of lower wage and poorer workers. Unlike being a member of Congress, the work that these people do tends to require heavy lifting, which can make you old fast. Requiring them to do it even deeper into old age and to wait longer for medical assistance is, as Krugman bluntly calls it, cruel. Bear in mind, too, that working-class families are precisely the people who count on Social Security and Medicare. They don't have the socialized medical benefits and golden pensions that those pampered conventional wisdom spouters in Congress get. Oh, one more thing. The purported savings from this fix are so minimal as to be illusory. In fact, shoving ill or crippled elderly workers out of the cost-effective Medicare system will jack up America's health care costs. This is Jim Hightower saying, so raising the retirement age is gratuitous as well as cruel, but mostly it's severely ignorant. What's at work here is a policy-making elite that includes no working-class people, so it can cluelessly believe that making the lives of these Americans worse is painless.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
Yes, we embrace free markets with free money. Yes, yes, here, come take our lottery, come take our wine and spirit shops, come take our things, and we will pay you for them, and we'll guarantee you profits. I go back and I think of the interview I had done not too long ago with Donna Cooper, who worked in the Rendell administration, and she was talking about, they were thinking about leasing the turnpike, which I was dead set against. Don't care who it is, I'm against it. But she said that the people who were going to lease it wanted in writing a guarantee that they were going to make as much money leasing the turnpike as they would anywhere else. So the opportunity cost they would have guaranteed, no matter where they would have used that money, it was going to be guaranteed in the turnpike. So they got paid first. It's much like the charter school thing that's going on, the privatization of our education. The charter schools get paid first before the public schools get paid first. I mean, that's their MO. And they're going to go through everything that we do. Everything that we do for us, this is how it's going to work. And they've gotten away with it because, well, they control things. And you go, well, how'd they get in control? How'd they have this much control? Well, creative districting. You know, you look at the fact that, in the last election here in the state of Pennsylvania, Democrats won statewide offices overwhelmingly, yet only controlled 5 of the 18 congressional races. And the Republican State Leadership Committee, they released a report here recently that, it was titled, How a Strategy of Targeting State Legislative Races in 2010 Led to a Republican U.S. House Majority in 2013. And they talk about how they spent a little money in 2010 off of the T-Twit anger, off of the ginned-up stuff that the media was throwing out at us constantly. There's a movement, and there are these people who have money, lots of it. Well, they spent some money in 2010, and they got a lot of these seats. And they were able to do it, and they got to be able to be the ones who had the drawing pen. They're the ones who had the crayon. And if you looked at the redistricting here in Pennsylvania, the one that was ruled unconstitutional on the federal level, or on the state level, the federal level actually went through, here's why. And I've been spending a lot of time looking at some of these gerrymandered districts. Oh, my goodness. Rorschach would be going, oh, my God, it's insane. I don't see anything. They have gerrymandered this entire thing. And, this report that they put out pretty much brags about it. And said, you know what, hey, voters didn't pull the lever for us. And yet we enjoy a 33-seat margin in the House because of that gerrymandering. So when they say, well, we won the House, yeah, gerrymandering. That's it. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's going on in New York City with the school bus drivers. Quick break. Right back.
Ocean of Red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at therickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
Earth, sky.
Just like you or me, Earth casts a shadow. Earth's shadow extends into space in the direction opposite the sun.
There are several good times to think about and be aware of Earth's shadow. For example, you can see Earth's shadow any evening ascending in the east. It ascends at the same rate that the sun is setting below the western horizon. The shadow is a deep blue-gray, and it's darker than the blue of the twilight sky. The pink band above the shadow is called the Belt of Venus. And just so you'll recognize it, remember that the shadow is curved in just the same way that the whole Earth is curved.
You can also see Earth's shadow during an eclipse of the moon. Earth's shadow extends so far into space that it can touch the moon. That's what a lunar eclipse is. It's the moon within Earth's shadow. During a lunar eclipse, a small amount of light from the sun filters through our planet's atmosphere onto Earth's shadow on the moon. That's why, at the middle part of a total lunar eclipse, the shadow on the moon looks reddish.
There's a third time to think about seeing Earth's shadow, and that is, night is a shadow. When night falls, you're standing within the shadow of Earth. So check out Earth's shadow, in the east just after sunset, brushing the moon's face during a lunar eclipse, or think about it when you're standing outside in darkness after sunset. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
We don't get it! Shut him down! If we don't get it!
Shut him down!
We don't get it!
Shut him down!
If we don't get it!
Shut him down!
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So you see what's going on in New York City. The school bus drivers have said, you know what, we'd like to protect our jobs. We'd like to be able to keep our jobs. And I saw this quote from Mayor Bloomberg that just stopped me in my tracks. He says, it is irrational for us to keep spending this much money if there's an alternative. He's talking about these bus drivers who are making somewhere in the range of $30,000 to $40,000 a year, starting somewhere in the area of $14 an hour. And the first thought is that irrational? What's irrational, in my view, is a guy worth $25 billion telling me it's irrational that workers make $30,000 to $40,000 a year. Something completely screwed up about that. And here to talk about what's going on in New York is Larry Hanley. He's president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU.org. This is the union that represents these bus drivers. Larry, thanks for taking time for me.
It's my pleasure, Rick.
So I've got this irrational in my head. Mayor Bloomberg says it's irrational to keep spending this money. Am I missing something?
No, welcome to America in 2013. This is the world that the rich want to build. And, Bloomberg is bringing a new off-Broadway show to New York. It's called Poverty, and the tickets are free. And he's really – this is an outright assault on some of the hardest-working, most dedicated people in the city. It represents exactly what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin, just done in a slightly different way. But it is class warfare at its worst.
Explain to me how it is that, and maybe you're seeing, because the news reports I'm seeing is, it's such a hardship on people, and all of this negative stuff about the bus drivers and the union, and explain to me how it is that it's not irrational to think that I'm going to give my most precious possession, my most precious resource as a nation, my children, to someone making minimum wage.
Well, I guess that throughout history there have always been a class of people who believe that average working people really don't deserve the same kind of lifestyle. Well, forget the same kind of lifestyle, any decent lifestyle. I can't explain the mayor's actions except, the thing that we always hope is not true about people. The thing that even though we know better, we think, well, maybe he just doesn't get it. Maybe this is not some manifestation of evil. But you know what, Rick? It is. This is greed at its worst and a complete, utter disrespect for the people who work every day on behalf of the citizens of our country and of our cities.
So what is the offer that the city is making? I mean, what's the impasse? What made the workers there go, you know what, our backs are against the wall, we're taking to the street?
Well, it's not about a contract. It's not about an offer. What it is that for 50 years in this city, while school bus service has been provided through contracted work, there has been an understanding in various forms that the workers who are engaged in driving and being matrons on school buses will follow their work if a new contractor takes over. The mayor has now issued new bids which take away that protection from the workers. So what happens then is that there will be wage competition between the companies so that the company that prepares a budget that offers the least amount of wages for the people in the city who work in this industry is the one who will win the bid.
So we're talking classic race to the bottom.
Absolutely. No question about it. That's exactly what this is.
So it's not about making the system more efficient. It's not about making the system work better for the kids. It's about stealing wages.
Well, yeah, and as a matter of fact, Bloomberg's entire argument is that the costs of this industry have escalated by 1,600% in the last 40 years. And that is about efficiency issues, not about wages. The wages have gone up in that period of time 400%. Which is comparable to any other wage inflation in the country. Matter of fact, it's at the low end because it only involves working people, not Wall Street. But the mayor has not told the public that the real drivers of cost in this system is the fact that the buses go to more places, they handle more handicapped kids, they take them to schools that are outside of the city, even outside of the state. And, you know, there are special needs children who require a great deal of attention, some of whom have not only a driver, but two assistants to get them up and down stairs on the bus and so forth. And it's an inexpensive thing. What the mayor's done is that he said, look at the cost, and blamed it on workers whose average salary is $38,000 a year.
Well, I mean, that's the easy line. That's the A to B. Where the easiest solution is blame the folks with the least amount of power. But in this case, at least these folks are organized and are represented by folks like you.
Well, let me tell you, these are great workers. You know, one of these workers, by the way, in 2009 was a CNN Hero of the Year because in his spare time, he feeds the homeless. And I don't mean just he hands a sandwich out in the corner. He takes hours and hours out of every day to cook meals and raise money and go out and personally feed homeless people. And this is after working all day, driving kids to and from school. So these are regular, hardworking Americans who are now being victims yet again of corporatists like Bloomberg.
You know, the thing that bothers me is you look at all, you hear all this vitriol, all this talk about, wow, there's so much waste, fraud, and abuse in these systems. We need to go after that. And yet I never hear anyone talk about going after the real waste, fraud, and abuse that we pay in extortion money to Wall Street. Not a peep.
Yep, that's right. And by the way, now that you mentioned Wall Street, I should also tell you that if Bloomberg's scheme goes through, there are thousands of retired school bus workers who could lose as much as half of their existing pensions because, you know, like what happened in the airlines and other industries, these school bus companies, if they lose their long-term contracts with the city, are likely to go bankrupt and default on their pension obligations.
Man, you know, you listen to this, and it just blows my mind, the short sight. And to me, I guess it's just tip of the nose. I'd like to believe it's just tip of the nose politic, but there's that jaded part of me that goes, this is the systematic dismantling of every institution that my grandparents' generation fought, bled, and died for, so that my generation and my kids and their kids could have a better tomorrow.
That's right. And you know, in our lifetimes, certainly in mine, I think I'm a little older than you. I've seen one industry after the other in the States get attacked this way. Often by its own business leaders. And I think Americans have watched their jobs and their incomes deteriorate almost in disbelief, thinking this can't be true or, you know, it's just something weird that's happening. It is weird, but it's concerted, it's planned, and it's being carefully executed by people on Wall Street who are simply trying to turn America and our cities into profit centers for them.
Yeah. How much of this is the privatization of education in New York? Because I honestly don't know the setup. I know here in Pennsylvania we've got a governor who's working diligently to privatize our public education system. So I guess we may be looking at kind of the same thing, because here in Harrisburg, they were actually talking about doing away with kindergarten in the public school. But as a matter of state law, the Harrisburg School District had to provide transportation for the charter school kids. How much of what's going on in New York is led by this push to profitize and privatize education?
Well, it's the same story. First, you know, again, this is privatized service. It has been for a very long time in New York City in terms of the bus service itself. However, the identical thing you just pointed out is happening in New York. The charter schools tend to be further away from children's homes, so that as the mayor has expanded charter schools around the city, the need for yellow bus transportation to get kids there has expanded, and that is one of the factors in the growing costs of school bus operations in New York. So now the mayor then comes up with this ridiculous cock and bull story that the problem is the workers' salaries, and he is trying to drive down the overall cost of his program to privatize the schools themselves by taking it out of the pockets of bus drivers and matrons.
Yeah, and that's the MO. But, you know, for me, I look at this, and this what's going on in New York is kind of the system that I think is the right one. If you want to privatize and you want to compete and you want to have companies going at each other, fine. But they should be doing it on quality, efficiency, who can do it better, not who can do it cheaper and how much we can steal from people who are doing it.
That's right. And, you know, the other story in education in New York today is that the mayor has failed to reach an agreement with the teachers union on teacher evaluations, and because there's a midnight deadline on funding, the city will lose $450 million. And this is all because of this national nonsense about, you know, teacher evaluation somehow being the cure to our problems.
Yeah, like standardized testing was.
Right. You know, and I, you know, from my point of view, we had teacher evaluations up in Connecticut a few weeks ago. We really saw what teachers do, and if you can look at what those teachers did there, in saving their kids, I think that answers the question about the value of teachers in our schools.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Let me ask you a last line of questioning, because, you know, some of the reports that I've seen say this is going to be a long, drawn-out strike since the mayor there in New York isn't even talking to the union. Where do you see this going?
The last time this happened was 1979. The strike lasted for 14 weeks, and that was when the mayor was a little more reasonable. This mayor is lame duck, and he is a multi-billionaire, and his attitude is my way or the highway, so this could turn into a not only a long strike, but hopefully this could be something like the Chicago teacher strike that might ignite some national attention and get people to really understand who the enemy is here and what, you know, people like Bloomberg are doing to our country and our world.
And hopefully wake people up, because, you know, the teacher strike in Chicago, I think, did wake a lot of folks up of what direct action, what to be getting into the street and actually standing your ground, saying, you know, enough is enough already, what you can actually accomplish.
Well, I can tell you that the plans are afoot to really get out there and start talking directly to the people in the city who are doing well. You know, there are people in the city who are competing fiercely to rent an apartment for $50,000 a month. And those people are going to hear from us about what their mayor is doing to our people.
Which just blows my mind. Irrational. 38,000 a year? The average?
Yeah, the average is $38,000 a year.
I don't know how you live on $38,000 a year in New York City.
Impossible. And, you know, these are people that are working hard and have two-income families and are struggling. And this is what the mayor's doing.
Larry, I wish you nothing but the best. As this continues, I'd love to have you back and some of your other folks to talk about what's going on.
Love to, and never trust a billionaire.
I don't. Thanks so much. Larry Hanley, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU.org, the website. Quick break, right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 8,000 school bus drivers, members of Amalgamated Transit Local 1181, are on strike in New York City. Amalgamated Transit Union International President Larry Hanley.
We are the common victims of a mayor who is a billionaire and completely out of touch and out of control. He has picked this fight, staged it, brought it about on his calendar, not on any other schedule. He has an open fight with every worker who is employed by him right now in the city. He is refusing to negotiate contracts with cops and firemen and sanitation workers and teachers. The people are the victims, and they should stand with us and tell this mayor to just cut it out and start being a mayor and stop being a billionaire.
The union says after 50 years of job protections and wage stability for school bus drivers, Mayor Bloomberg arbitrarily threw that out by putting school bus contracts up for bids among private companies. That means the workers could suddenly lose their jobs or have their wages and benefits lowered.
The ATU tried to avert a strike over the issue, but Hanley says Bloomberg won't even talk to the union. Hanley says ATU school bus drivers are committed to getting school children safely to and from school. He says safety is enhanced by job and wage stability among drivers because qualified, experienced drivers stay on the job longer. Hanley says the people of New York and the union bus drivers are victims of a right-wing attack on working people.
This is Wisconsin and Michigan having come to New York City. It is a mayor who is on the same right-wing agenda, although sometimes he hides it, that Scott Walker has been on in Wisconsin. This is the right-wing Tea Party attack on working people, and people in this country really need to take stock of what's happening and stand up with organized labor in New York as they have stood with organized labor around the country.
French auto workers near Paris have occupied a plant to protest layoffs. Jesse Russell reports.
Peugeot Citroën workers near Paris have occupied a plant in protest of planned layoffs. The company is in the process of laying off 8,000 workers and closing that plant. According to a union representing the workers, nearly 300 have stopped production at the plant, bringing work practically to a standstill. There are roughly 3,000 employees at the plant, but the majority of the striking workers are on the production line. Europe hasn't shared in North America's rebound of the auto industry. The European Union saw new car registrations drop by 16% at the end of 2012. The union has been seeking early retirement offers for the workers who are over the age of 55. But so far, the company has been unwilling to offer such incentives. Peugeot's competitor, Renault, is also planning layoffs, but they're doing so by offering early retirement plans and not bringing on new hires.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls come tumbling down. The walls come tumbling, tumbling. The walls come tumbling, tumbling down.
I got to tell you, I worry about that every time I pass over one of the bridges. And, you know, I went back and I read some campaign material our governor, Mr. Transparency, put out while he was running for governor. And in one of the reports on infrastructure, he wrote, Pennsylvania has over 20,000 bridges. Almost 30% of them are deemed structurally deficient, with another 20% functionally obsolete. He says, in addition, Overdrive magazine, in its annual trucker survey, has identified Pennsylvania as the state with the overall worst roads. Tom Corbett said, candidate Corbett said, infrastructure, specifically transportation infrastructure, is one of the key factors companies and site selectors consider for business site selection. And he pointed out back then, Pennsylvania ranked 47th in the nation in job creation, and his assessment will likely to remain there unless infrastructure needs are addressed. Now, this is years ago. This was back when he was candidate, not governor. So what's he done for the last 2 years? Absolutely nothing. So now there's some talk. Maybe something's going to get done, which is why I've asked our friend Abe Amoros, the Pennsylvania Legislative Director for the Laborers International Union, to come talk to us. Abe, thanks for taking time for me.
You're welcome. It's good to be with you.
So I look at this campaign literature that our governor ran on. We've got all these bridges, a large percentage of them structurally deficient, obsolete, worst roads in the country, key component in jobs, yet for 2 years he did, well, nothing.
You're absolutely right, Rick. Yes. And you hit the nail right on the head in your intro there, my friend. There are 5,205 bridges that are rated as structurally deficient. When you combine that with 8,452 miles of highway that need to be repaved and have a poor roughness index, I mean, you're talking about major work that needs to be done. And you're right. For the first 2 years, his first full 2 years of his governorship, nothing has been done. In fact, what they did, Rick, is they dusted off an old report from the Transportation Funding Advisory Commission that came out in August 2011, and now they're trying to put something on the table. Now, I hope that this comes to full fruition because, obviously, it's going to put a lot of people back to work, and that's what we need, Rick.
Yeah, but we needed it 2 years ago.
You're right. You're absolutely right. We needed it 2 years ago because every day – that we go without fixing our infrastructure is $1 million a day. Right now, the need is at about $3.5 billion. And every day that goes by with inaction, with no action taking place, is an additional $1 million.
Yeah, the $3.5 million, though, Abe, was back in 2010.
Right.
That number has gone way up since then, because as you pointed out, $1 million every day. So now you're looking at over $4 billion because we've had complete inaction. And, in fact, their report says that if we wait until 2020, it'll be up to $7.2 billion, not to mention all of the other costs.
That's right, and that's absolutely unacceptable. We need action immediately. Immediately. Now, as I understand it, Rick, he's going to make an announcement the week of January the 28th, and it can't come a minute sooner than that, quite frankly, because we have to start this right away with construction season just around the corner. It would be good to have an infusion of money set aside to fix our ailing infrastructure because it is in such poor shape. And my biggest fear, Rick, is that we're going to have something similar to Minnesota where a bridge collapses and kills innocent people.
Yep.
Because the maintenance just isn't there, the repair isn't there, and the political will isn't there either. And I'm hoping that this legislature will realize that we just simply cannot afford it in terms of dollars and cents, but more importantly, lives.
Now, I'm right there with you. And, you know, I go back to that I-35 collapse in Minnesota where I loved the official line on it. It was bird droppings.
Huh.
It was the birds. The
wow.
Birds would land, and they would go right there. And that corroded everything. And over years and years and years of, as you've pointed out, no maintenance, that's what caused it.
Yes, and that's absolutely reprehensible. And when we live in a state where, which is a major thoroughfare in the Northeast, a major corridor. And like you said in your intro, once again, I mean, trucking companies, engineers, I mean, they consider us to be the worst state in terms of infrastructure with all the miles that we have with not just the turnpike, but the highway miles, I-80, 83, 81, 78. These things need to be fixed because of commerce, obviously. We have congestion problems as well that cost money. Everything can be boiled down to money and safety. And more inaction by the legislature simply cannot be tolerated. I understand that the chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee, Senator Bob Rafferty, also has a bill that he's going to introduce very soon. I believe it's going to be Senate Bill 1 that addresses the need for infrastructure spending. It's got to be done. They can't waste time on this. And again, with construction season just around the corner and unemployment at about 17.5% in the construction industry in Pennsylvania, that could put a lot of people back to work with good paying family sustaining jobs with health care benefits and pensions as well. This is a win-win, and the legislature simply cannot continue to drag its feet on this, and the governor has to make a really big splash. Now, Rick, I'm a little bit of a cynic. I know he needs a big issue because his numbers are really tanking right now in terms of popularity and favorability. I understand it's still at 38%. So he has an opportunity to fix his numbers a little bit, but by doing the right thing and pumping the necessary dollars into infrastructure, and I'm hoping it's not just something like a billion or 1.5, which is what I'm hearing, Rick. That would be disconcerting. Like you said, that 3.5 billion is 3 years old now with $1 million a day. There has to be some serious money pumped into the infrastructure.
And we need the jobs. You know, but but there's the cynic. I mean, I was going to ask you about this. You know, how much of this do you think is campaign motivated? I mean, you need to, you know, infuse some king. So I've been saying he should have done it 2 years ago, but, you know, politically it didn't play real well. Now that we're starting to look at the election's going to start, election season's coming around the corner. You need to get that cash out there, get people back to work as we knew it would do 2 years ago so that maybe he gets reelected.
Right. What you're right, Rick. Obviously, there is something behind it. He's not doing this out of the goodness of his heart. He's doing it for political reasons, no question about it. But the timing is perfect in terms of doing it now. I mean, it should have been done 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and it's got to be done now. This is the opportunity. The stars are aligning, And I'm going to be very disappointed if it's just a drop in the bucket and more lip service, because that's not going to benefit anybody.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, you're the guy who knows about this stuff. I mean, transportation, this kind of funding, fixing roads, bridges, doing this kind of basic things that have to be done, this used to be very bipartisan, and I shouldn't even say bipartisan, nonpartisan.
That's exactly right, Rick. And we got away from that because every time that you talk about enhancing revenues, anytime you're talking about spending money on things that need to be spent, we need to have money spent on, like our infrastructure, Republicans run away and say, oh, it's going to cost too much. This is crazy. We can't afford tax increases because you're talking about, you know, raising the revenues through the gasoline tax. Nobody wants to have the gasoline tax go up. In fact, one of the governor's biggest supporters recently came out and said, oh, no, we can't have that. We're going to have gasoline prices at close to $4 a gallon again. We can't do that. So there are always naysayers. And like you said, this used to be bipartisan. But, you know, the Republicans, they just run and hide from the issue rather than attacking it head on. They're always complaining about raising taxes. They go back as disciples of Grover Norquist. And I just don't understand it. This is something that has to be done for the betterment of the entire infrastructure of the Commonwealth, Democrats or Republicans.
Well, I think, and as the governor pointed out, if you have a crummy infrastructure, you're not going to get the jobs. I mean, that's just common sense. But, you know, in talking about the gas tax, you know, in this report that they put out, that the Transportation Funding Advisory Commission put out, they actually said in their recommendations that they were their funding levels were developed with the directive not to consider raising the gas tax. So even though the beginning of their studies, that's just completely off the table, which to me it seems one of the more rational ideas,
right,
that you should be raising that as fuel efficiency goes up and as we end up driving more miles. And I'm in favor of charging trucks much more because they tear our roads up much more.
That's right, Rick, and they're going to pay. Those trucking companies are going to wind up paying it. What are they going to do? Not go through Pennsylvania? Are they going to actually hurt their bottom line by going around Pennsylvania and raising their costs? Of course not. You're right. Everyone needs to pay their fair share to make this happen because Pennsylvania remains a major thoroughfare in the Northeast.
And I think truck drivers would be happy to pay it because, look, you know, I drove for years, and I remember at one point I had gotten roads are so bad in this state, and I will attest to it right now. I was going from Carlisle to Allentown, in the left-hand lane with a cop behind me with flashing lights on, wanting to pull me over because I wasn't in the right-hand lane. When the cop came up and said, hey, you know, what are you doing? I go, that right lane's just death. You can't stay in the seat. You gotta get over. She goes, you're right. Go on. Because even the cop knew the roads were bad.
That's exactly right, Rick. I mean, you've lived it. You've seen it. I mean, you did it on a daily basis, and I mean, there's so many truckers out there who don't mind paying the extra, and the companies don't mind paying the extra because it's going to save them money in the long run as well.
And you know, the reality is, it's going to save wear and tear on their vehicles as well, and as us as consumers. And I, you know, like I said earlier in the program, I interviewed Donna Cooper not too long ago, and she said every vehicle owner in this state, on average, it costs, because of our crummy roads, about $600 a year in repairs.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And if we have major investments today, that amount is going to go down and eventually disappear, simply because the time for this kind of investment is now. And I really do hope, Rick, that the legislature embraces this and forces the governor to put something that's realistic and something that's much needed out there. And again, not lip service. We don't need $1 billion. We don't need $1.5 billion. We need 3.5 to start with. I hope that the starting point is a realistic one and not one that's just going to score them cheap political points. We don't need cheap political points. We need to have these roads and bridges fixed before we have a catastrophe.
Yeah, and we need to fund it. I mean, have you seen the news reports going around that he's talking about taking the cap off of the oil franchise tax?
Yes, I have seen that, and he's getting a lot of flack from the right as a result of it because, again, they don't live in a world that's reality-based, Rick. They live in a world that's based upon ideology and just crazy talk. They don't want to do anything.
Well, I guess, you know, it's like I see this fight over the debt ceiling, Abe.
Yeah.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Right, that's exactly right. So I'm really looking forward to this announcement, and I'm going to tear it apart. I mean, I'm going to look at it word for word, number by number, statistic by statistic, and we're really going to make a major push to members of the legislature on both sides to make sure that something realistic takes place, because at the end of the day, everybody wins. Pennsylvanians win with better infrastructure, and our workers are put back to work as well. They've been on the bench too long. We need to help them out also.
And when you do, when you rip those numbers apart, we'd like to have you come back and walk us through it. Last question, what do we do? How do we get this pushed through? What's the suggestion? What's the marching order?
I'll tell you what we need to do. We need to start off with all the members of each transportation committee, Rick. So go see those chairs in all four caucuses, Democrat and Republican. Go look at the lists of those who are on the transportation committee. Have people call them up and pester them and say, give us something that's realistic, something that's going to work, and no more lip service.
I'm with you. Abe Amoroso, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Likewise. Thank you, Rick.
Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Corruption are very well known. On a consumer code of silence is what they defend. We know it, so let's don't pretend. You and me know it, so let's don't pretend.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
In the scramble to fix the federal deficit, one of Washington's worst ideas is widely considered by political elites, including some Democrats, to be a good idea, even a painless fix. The idea is to raise the age of eligibility for both Social Security and Medicare, shoving it from 65 to 67 or beyond. After all, goes Washington's conventional wisdom, people live so much longer now, so it won't hurt to postpone eligibility and save a couple of years of taxpayer outlays to people. But, as economist and columnist Paul Krugman has pointed out, this bit of conventional wisdom is merely conventional, in the sense of trite. While life expectancy has gone up on average, it has not increased much for working stiffs, especially tens of millions of lower wage and poorer workers. Unlike being a member of Congress, the work that these people do tends to require heavy lifting, which can make you old fast. Requiring them to do it even deeper into old age and to wait longer for medical assistance is, as Krugman bluntly calls it, cruel. Bear in mind, too, that working-class families are precisely the people who count on Social Security and Medicare. They don't have the socialized medical benefits and golden pensions that those pampered conventional wisdom spouters in Congress get. Oh, one more thing. The purported savings from this fix are so minimal as to be illusory. In fact, shoving ill or crippled elderly workers out of the cost-effective Medicare system will jack up America's health care costs. This is Jim Hightower saying, so raising the retirement age is gratuitous as well as cruel, but mostly it's severely ignorant. What's at work here is a policy-making elite that includes no working-class people, so it can cluelessly believe that making the lives of these Americans worse is painless.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
We imagine a pink unicorn. Now, if you had a pink unicorn, how many
dollars in taxes would you raise to trade for the pink unicorn? Since pink unicorns do not exist in the real world, it has never occurred to me to worry about the senator from South Carolina. He's not going to vote for a deal because the kind of 10-to-1 ratio deal he's talking about with real ironclad spending cuts is never going to happen.
Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows.
Like Abe said, our governor taking a little flack from the anti-taxers. Well, you can't raise that tax. That would hurt businesses. You think about all the money we've given away to big corporations over the last 2 years, as we're stealing money from education, as we're eviscerating the general assistance budget, kicking the 70,000 of the most vulnerable to the curb. You can go through all of the cuts that have happened to the working poor and to the misfortunate in this country, and you go in this state, and you go, we need to give more tax breaks to big corporations. And you look at this, I've read this entire study put forth by the Transportation Funding Advisory Commission. And look, they're right, $3.5 billion in need in 2010. That has gone up, as they put up, said, $1 million a day until 2020, when they say it's going to cost us somewhere in the neighborhood of $7.2 billion that we'll have in unmet needs. And one of the things that they point out is one of the problems that we're going to have is, while on the national level, the Obama administration has said we have to raise the CAFE standards. So if your car is getting 20 miles to the gallon today, and it goes up to, I think it's 50, and down the road, gas tax not going up, so you're going to have a decrease in revenue coming in for the same mile driven. Just common sense, you've got to make that up somewhere. Now, there are some folks who say, well, what we need to do is we need to raise that gas tax up, make it go up with inflation, make it go up with efficiency and productivity gains, so that you're still getting the same dollar to fix the same road that needs to be fixed, even though you're driving a little bit more because of these efficiencies. Now, there are those who believe we should do away with the gas tax. And if you remember during the Bush years, well, we need to have a gas tax holiday. Kept throwing that out an awful lot. In fact, John McCain was a huge, huge fan of that during his campaign. Now the other part of this, and it's one of those things that go, okay, the other right-wing view is, well, we eliminate it. Do away with it. Sales tax. In fact, the governor of Virginia, who I guess is going to be soon out the door, that was his idea. We need the gas tax. We need to get rid of the gas tax, replace it with a sales tax, increase that. So you know what happens? Well, people who don't drive, that's right, you end up paying more for it, especially you poor people who don't own cars, who live maybe in cities who use public transportation and pay for that. You get to pay for that as well. And again, I look at this, it's a nice give back to the very wealthy. According to the report I read, it's an ambitious overhaul of how Virginia pays for its roads. The overhaul plan, which would raise an estimated $3.1 billion over 5 years, would also increase vehicle registration fees, something Governor Corbett wants to do. And I love this, instead of raising the gas tax to meet the needs of the efficiency and the productivity and the better gas mileage. No. What they're going to do in Virginia, if you bought one of those alternative fuel cars, if you bought an electric car, if you got something different than a good old gas guzzler, they're going to charge you $100. That's right. You're going to get $100 a year, penalty, if you will, for buying an alternative car. And I read that and I go, well, wait a second. Don't we want to get off of using so much foreign oil? Don't we want to get off the fossil fuels? Even if it's through efficiency, isn't that the goal? Instead of punishing people for going to alternative vehicles, shouldn't we be encouraging it? And I saw this and I go, it's exactly the right wing ideology. So they're going to raise the tax on the sales tax from their 5% up to 5.8, and they're going to use $1 billion, they claim, from internet sales tax revenue, which I guess is something that's still pending in Congress. And, I started thinking about this. And I seem to remember this certain fake grassroots organization who complained an awful lot about redistribution of wealth. That seemed to pop into my mind because that's what this is. You know, the people who are, and you think about this, the people who are using the roads, you think about the big trucking companies are going to get away with this because that's gone too. You think about, you know, these, the people who can afford to have cars, they're going to get away with it, away from paying for what they're using. And now, what the right loves to tell us, to understand their ideology. Big fans of consumption tax, big fans of personal responsibility, so they tell us, this is going to let the people who use the roads not have to pay for them. Because we're going to, it's going to be everybody. And there's part of me that goes, you know, I'm not against that idea. As long as you're not, it's not disproportionately harming those at the bottom. And that's what this kind of scheme does. Because you look at the fact that you're making $10,000 or $15,000 a year. That 0.8% increase in sales tax on everything you consume is huge. Especially when you don't have a car. Evidently, they're going to be the first state in the nation who's going to get rid of their gas tax. And I guess I look at this and I go, you know, it's the ideology. Gotta have flat tax. Heard a lot of that. Gotta have flat tax. Well, if you think about it, a gas tax kind of is a flat tax, isn't it? Every mile you drive, you're going to pay a tax on. Virginia, not so much. Now, understand, Virginia, like Pennsylvania, they haven't risen. They haven't allowed their gas tax to rise in decades. So what they've done, and as I've said this before, we've allowed politicians to get away with this idea of we're not raising taxes. Granted, we're living off the investments of the past. Granted, we're living off of hoping and praying that things don't crumble before our very eyes, just so we can say, hey, we didn't do it. We didn't raise your taxes. Be happy with us. And the guy in Virginia is going to do a bunch of the same things that Corbett's going to do, raise registration fees. I love the one thing that the transportation people came out with, that if you get caught driving without insurance here in the Commonwealth right now, your registration is suspended for 3 months. That's the current law. In the new Corbett world, no need for that. We'll just charge you $500, and you can continue right on driving. And you look at this and you go, well, wait a second. The whole idea of suspending it for 3 months is to incentivize don't not have insurance. Kind of that thought. But no, now it's just about money. And I guess that's about it. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about our infrastructural needs on the national level. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Into this house we're born.
Values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
Earth, sky.
Just like you or me, Earth casts a shadow. Earth's shadow extends into space in the direction opposite the sun.
There are several good times to think about and be aware of Earth's shadow. For example, you can see Earth's shadow any evening, ascending in the east. It ascends at the same rate that the sun is setting below the western horizon. The shadow is a deep blue-gray, and it's darker than the blue of the twilight sky. The pink band above the shadow is called the belt of Venus. And just so you'll recognize it, remember that the shadow is curved in just the same way that the whole Earth is curved.
You can also see Earth's shadow during an eclipse of the moon. Earth's shadow extends so far into space that it can touch the moon. That's what a lunar eclipse is. It's the moon within Earth's shadow. During a lunar eclipse, a small amount of light from the sun filters through our planet's atmosphere onto Earth's shadow on the moon. That's why, at the middle part of a total lunar eclipse, the shadow on the moon looks reddish.
There's a third time to think about seeing Earth's shadow, and that is, night is a shadow. When night falls, you're standing within the shadow of Earth. So check out Earth's shadow, in the east just after sunset, brushing the moon's face during a lunar eclipse, or think about it when you're standing outside in darkness after sunset. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
I want it now, exactly. I want an infrastructure plan. I want a transportation bill. I want some funding. I want people back to work. Yeah, I want it, and I want it now. In fact, we should have had it 2 years ago, and like we talked earlier with Abe Amaros from the Laborers International Union, you know, it's good news that the governor here is finally talking about investing. Granted, he's a little bit behind, 2 years behind the curve. But election time is coming around. And I look at this new report put out by the American Society of Civil Engineers. And they say right now our infrastructure deficit stands at $1.6 trillion. And they say over the next decade, it's going to grow to $2.75 trillion. And they go into this report, goes into all of the negative effects, the loss of jobs. I think they say somewhere around 3.5 million jobs could be lost by us not investing in infrastructure, about $3.1 trillion in GDP that we will lose, as well as more than $1 trillion in total trade that we will lose. So austerity, folks, not working. And for people who live in Harrisburg, just one point, 40 sinkholes in the last year here in the city of Harrisburg, mostly because we've got sewers and water pipes that are eroding under our feet. We've got to do something. We've got to do it now, which is why I've asked Ed Witkin, president of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO, to come talk to us. Ed, thanks for taking time for me.
Anytime. Glad to be back.
You know, so I look at this report, and there's opportunity for job growth, and we've had this conversation before. I guess what's it going to take for us to wake up and say, you know what, 3.5 million jobs over the next decade could be lost by not investing now?
Well, we have to stop electing people into office who don't understand that this nation was built on the infrastructure that that we all sort of take for granted, and it is literally crumbling beneath us. And if we keep electing the same people but expect a better outcome, I think isn't that there's some definition of an insanity there somewhere, isn't it?
Yep.
And so that's really our problem. Our politics are broken, and we have to do a better job of convincing Republicans that they can't treat transportation and infrastructure the same way they treat other budget and appropriations issues that they view as sort of pork barrel unnecessary spending. If we don't replace our bridges, if we don't give more money to our transit rail systems, our country just sort of comes to a screeching halt. And this report you you talked about, I read through it. It's another startling glimpse into just how bad things are getting.
Yeah, I mean, but it's not new. I mean, we've known this for a couple of years now. So I guess the big question is you know, And I look to the federal government because I think that at some point in the past, this used to be nonpartisan, and we got to get back there. So what can on the federal government, what can they do to help us with this on the state level? Because here, you know, this report that the governor's been sitting on for well over a year says $3.5 billion in unmet needs next decade, up to almost $7.2 billion of unmet needs.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, I mean, the feds do need to step up. We have a president who's actually made transportation an important part of his economic agenda, but he hasn't found a partner in Congress to do it. And it doesn't help, by the way, to have a bunch of governors out there, like Kasich in Ohio and Scott in Florida and Walker in Wisconsin. And unfortunately, Christie in New Jersey, as popular as he's become, the way he handled the post-Sandy environment, they're fighting federal government investment transportation. In fact, all of them at one point in the last couple of years have sent money back to the feds that they had, you know, in their hands, in the palm of their hands, and they turned it down. So the environment's not rich right now to get this stuff done, but we're working on it, and I'm having some hope that, you know, as the things get worse, you know, Congress always seems to act. It's always too late, but they tend to step up when things get really bad.
Yeah, well, I hope we don't have another I-35.
No, I do, too. And, you know, as I always say, I've said it many times on the air, right? Bridges don't almost fall down. You know, they actually do. And when they do, you know, this is what you're stuck with. I might just remind your listeners that look at this disgusting fight we're having on the Sandy relief bill, right? You've got people's lives ruined on the East Coast. You have literally bridges swept away, tunnels flooded with hundreds and hundreds of millions of gallons of water, and the economy brought to its knees. And you've got Republicans in Gulf Coast states in the most hurricane, you know, ravaged states in the country voting against Sandy relief legislation. I mean, I tell you, I often wonder the planet I live on. I don't know what planet these guys live on.
Well, I mean, it's that team sport politic mentality. My team's not the one giving you this, so you don't get it.
Right. No, you're right. I keep saying maybe it's time to try to get the president to be against all this stuff. So maybe the Republicans will be for it because, you know, today I read an interview by some of the new incoming leaders on the Transportation Committee in the House who are already, you know, threatening to go after this program and that program and try to zero out high-speed rail funding in California. And it's just it never ends, Rick. And I tell you, it's an uphill struggle. But we're, you know, we've got the energy and the ability to fight the fight. We're going to fight the fight.
You know, I've quoted Thomas Friedman a couple of times over the last year or so. Someone I'm not a huge fan of, but I think he was absolutely right when he said that he had flown back from Beijing to LAX, and he said it was like coming back from going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. And you look at the fact that we have not been investing in our airports and a lot of things. And you look at these big Dreamliner planes, these massive birds we're throwing up in the air. And, you know, last year there were a couple of times where planes bumping into each other. We've outgrown our airports. And again, we're 30 years behind the curve. How do we get people like the FAA to get projects funded with some certainty? I mean, the Republicans love talking about certainty and uncertainty. I mean, uncertainty, look at our airports.
Well, yeah, the problem is that they don't want to fund it. And I don't really know why, because as many politicians have said many times before, you know, Republicans and Democrats both commute. They both stand in long lines in airports. They all like to get their goods to market if they're in the business community. And yet we have turned it into a partisan issue. How do we get them the resources? That's a good question. It's one that I will probably spend a lot of time the next few weeks and months trying to figure out. Because what's broken in our transportation funding system is we do not have a revenue source that can keep up with the cost. That's why, for example, I've been reading some of the stories written in Pennsylvania about what the governor is apparently close to unveiling. And what you have now, you've got these different governors around the country in both parties sort of experimenting with different approaches. I haven't had a chance to analyze all the proposals. But the reason there's this experimenting going on is because the feds are completely standing still. And so what's happening now is mayors and governors are being forced to basically do the job the federal government used to do, which is it used to be the entity, the institution that brought the resources down to the states and cities to build up their transportation systems. But it's just not getting done anymore.
Now, here's what bothers me, Ed. I mean, we're in a time right now when we can borrow money at almost for free. I mean, the rate is almost free. And I fear that we're missing an opportunity that we could since we haven't for the last 30 years really invested, what we've done is we've patchworked things. We haven't invested and expanded. We've patchworked, and even that's fallen behind. I'm afraid we're missing an opportunity to borrow this money at near zero rate interest and get people back to work, get our economy moving forward, and then have that 21st century infrastructure to move forward. And it bothers me because we used to be a nation that always built up to the best possible. And it just seems now like, well, what we got, that's good enough.
Yeah, and then, you know, today I spent some time at a meeting in Washington discussing the workforce development issues and training issues, which are very near and dear to my heart. But the topic I introduced to this conversation today was, yes, there is a training gap. Yes, we're not spending enough money on developing the workforce of the future. But as a lot of people have been saying in the labor movement for years now, while there is a shortage of training, while we do need to direct more resources to it, there's a shortage of good jobs. And so what I said at the podium today is I want to be able to look at a high school kid or a college kid or someone who wants to change careers and look them straight in the eyes and say that we are going to do what's right in this country to invest in our transportation system and its, you know, foundation, its infrastructure, and that the jobs that we're going to create doing that are going to be pathways to the middle class. And as you know, Rick, we're also doing stuff on the cheap everywhere we look. They're privatizing, contracting out. They're rigging procurements to make sure that they go to the lowball guy. They reward low wages and lousy benefits. So that's also a subplot to this, is that even if we do this, if we don't do it the right way, if we don't pick sort of a high road model to make sure that we make sure the jobs we create are actually worth a damn, then we're wasting our time. It doesn't matter how shiny the trains and buses are, but if you're asking people to work on those trains and buses at $15 an hour, it doesn't actually matter whether we do a good job or not, because the middle class is going to suffer for it.
Yeah, you know, I sat in on a pension hearing not too long ago here in the Commonwealth, and Daryl Metcalf, one of the guy who chaired one of our more radical right-wing extremists here, he actually, it was painfully apparent that it was his belief that government should be the leader in the race to the bottom. That, you know, if the private sector was privatizing pensions and everything was going to be a defined contribution plan, government should be leading the way. And if prevailing wage was too high, we should be leading the way to pull that down. And anything that benefited workers, you know, people who are just struggling to make ends meet, that should all be pulled back because, hey, profits are sacrosanct.
No, that's right. And, you know, we should probably devote one of your programs to this, and I'd love to participate in any discussions. Is one of the things that we could be working on as a movement, and we are starting to look at this issue, is we need to change the standard. We need to change the assumptions that go into how we do these large infrastructure projects, whether it's building something new or ordering new cars and equipment, making sure that you reward middle-class jobs when you judge these bids for these jobs. The problem now is we've created an environment, as I keep calling it, low-road environment, where all we're doing is rewarding anybody that can come in with a cheap bid that pays cheap wages. We have to start rewarding the bids that create middle-class jobs. And if you do that, then the business model changes. And then you and I don't have to worry that the low-bid guy is always going to win, that he's actually going to come in with a bid that makes sure that you give good wages and benefits to the employees.
Yep.
That's a debate that's not occurring either. You know, we're losing on both ends of the debate. We're not investing, and when we do, we're letting them get away with this low-road model that's just completely, you know, sandbagged the employees to get a job in these industries.
You know, and I've made that argument a number of times. You know, you go back and you look at, you know, some of the catastrophes we've had, like the earthquake in California years back. There were a number of studies done around that earthquake that the government investment into rebuilding the area actually helped them recover much faster, because every dollar that you put in rebuilding had a reverberation effect. And I think at the time it was like $3 that you got back in economic activity. And it's the same thing. The more money that we get into the hands of workers for doing these things, the better it is for the economy. And that's why we have prevailing wage laws, so that government programs, things that we're going to build for us, actually has a decent standard of living, so that we do raise people up. The floor under their feet is a step up.
Yeah, and you'll be shocked to learn that in the debate over the Sandy relief bill, there were some real extremists in the Republican side of the House who wanted to try to use Sandy legislation to attack Davis Bacon.
Of course.
Prevailing wages, of course.
but,
you know,
but Ed, during when Hurricane Katrina happened, they did away with the Fair Labor Standards Act. People could work for $1 an hour they wanted.
Yeah, no, and the other thing that that I think many people lost in this debate, I think it became more prominent when Republicans started attacking Republicans over this, is the hypocrisy of Gulf Coast Republicans, you know, participating in delays of New York, New Jersey, Sandy relief legislation. But Katrina got its first check in 11 days,
right,
in the Gulf Coast, Texas, Louisiana, et cetera. So, you know, I guess it's okay to help people that vote for you, not people that don't vote for you. It's a disgusting display of politics. It is probably the worst I've ever seen in my life working for the labor movement. I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, I'm with you. And the other thing, I think it was Peter King who brought it up.
Yeah, from New York. That's correct.
Well,
and, you know, Governor Christie did, too. I don't agree with many things he's done in his career so far, including very, you know, violent attacks on the labor movement politically, but he called it what it was. And by the way, it's his comments and Peter King's comments that moved the ball a bit.
Absolutely.
But they should still be ashamed of themselves for playing politics with people's lives.
Yeah, but the ironic thing for me, Ed, is that, you know, you look at the states that were against it, they're the ones who get the largest chunk of money from the federal government. And in New York, well, they're the ones, the net loser. They send a dollar to Washington. They get a fraction of that back.
No, that's right. And as I said, I said on Twitter, I went back and looked at the roll call vote. There was one or more Republicans in every major state that gets most of the disaster relief money in this country, not just all the Gulf Coast and southern states, but then throwing California because of earthquakes. And it's incredible.
It is
incredible. You know, as I said in a tweet I put out, I said, if government doesn't help people who have been, you know, whose lives have been wasted away by a natural disaster, what is the role of government? Isn't that the most basic function of government, is to try to give people relief?
No, it's defense.
I'm not sure there is anything more basic.
No, it's just defense, Ed. That's it. That's all government should do. And everything else, you're on your own.
I heard that. Yeah, I've heard that.
It's nuts. So let me ask you, you know, last question. You know, as this is going down the road, are there any actions planned? Are we doing anything? Because I'm a firm believer, you got to have people in the streets. The only time things get done is when the wheel's squeaking and people are out screaming, saying, "Hey, we want this and we demand it." Anything going on?
Nothing that is described by you yet. But look, we have a very large agenda in 2013. It's not a complicated one, but there's a lot of huge policy issues that are going to be debated in the Congress that are going to decide whether or not we invest in literally millions of jobs in this country. And yes, we will be doing some things outside of Washington, because what I'm learning more and more is that if you don't leave Washington for your, you know, for your sort of counterattacks against those that think all of this, you know, needs to be done by the private sector, there should be no federal involvement, et cetera, is that you lose if you try to win all your fights in Washington. So stay tuned, but we have a lot of big issues. We're trying to do some fairly simple things, right? Bring more investments to create middle-class jobs. Let's try this one. How about using federal taxpayer dollars to buy things that are made in America?
We've got
a large and vigorous Buy America agenda that we've been pushing and will continue to push. And yeah, stay tuned. We're going to be doing some things that are not always in Washington, because Washington isn't listening. It appears that people around the country are listening a lot more than their politicians are.
As you do that, we would love to have you back. It's always great to talk to you, Ed.
Anytime.
Whoa, appreciate that. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Changing America for the better.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pscu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hope of its children.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You know, you look at our transportation needs and, you know, all of the money that, as Eisenhower there said in his Cross of Iron speech, look, all of this money we're wasting, all of this we're squandering, all of this we're not spending on the things we need. We're, you know, the genius of our scientists, the hopes of our children, way squandered. And, you know, I look at the proposals, and I look at the governor's proposal, and I wonder what's going to come out. And I think talking to Abe Amoros, he says a billion, maybe a billion five, when we've got well over $4.5 billion in need, doesn't seem to me to be keeping up. And, you know, as Ed said, you know, a bridge doesn't almost collapse. So I look to this, you know, this recent study by the folks at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the statement that they've come out with. Because you remember, go back to Hurricane Katrina. In 2005, when that happened, there were reports for years that we hadn't been improving those levees. We hadn't been upgrading them, repairing them when needed. I haven't been doing it. And what the Army Corps of Engineers are saying is, look, there are a lot of levees around this country that have got the same thing. In fact, according to their investigations, they said inspectors taking the ever inventory of flood control systems overseen by the federal government have found 107 states. And I go back and I think about, you know, some of the arguments that we've heard from the right recently around the debt ceiling, around the fiscal cliff, and some of the budget proposals that they've made, gutting FEMA, gutting research, gutting investment, gutting, just looking down the road and going, hey, you know what? We may have problems. And for me, it comes back down to this very short-sighted politic. And I've been talking about this for years. You know, politicians say, oh, I'm not going to raise your taxes. My question is always, well, then how are you going to do things? Because costs go up. You know, this Transportation Advisory Commission, Funding Commission report that Corbett had done, they take into account, look, prices go up. We don't do it now, the cost of asphalt's going to go up next year. We don't do it now, the price of concrete's going to go up next year. We don't do it now, the price of steel's going to go up next year. You need to do it now. But it's this short-sighted, and it's with everything that we've done. You look at the issue, it's short-sighted. We've got politicians just looking to the next election. Man, I got to get elected. Got to get reelected. And it's on both sides of the political divide. But transportation used to be one of those things that, you know, hey, there are potholes in my town. I got to get the potholes fixed. I don't get the potholes fixed, I don't get reelected. It used to be nonpartisan. Now everything seems to be a death match. And more than it's a grudge death match. Can't let that guy look good. Look, I want Corbett. I want him coming out with a transportation bill. Even though I know it's going to put people back to work. It's going to make the economy start moving again. And he's going to look good doing it. I still want him to do it because it's the right thing to do. Not to mention, there are a thousand other things we can complain about that he's done. But this used to be nonpartisan. Used to be nonpartisan. And I look at the opportunity costs. And, you know, hey, for my economics people, the opportunity costs. 3.5 million jobs, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, if we don't invest in this. 3.5 million jobs gone. All of that business activity gone. And what's interesting to me, you've got labor organizations and the Chamber of Commerce who've said, we both want you to do it because it's the right thing to do. Going to take a quick break, back with hour three of the program. Stick around. If you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. That's where you get the podcast, Stitcher on the website, right back after this. We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the Vulcan?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 8,000 school bus drivers, members of Amalgamated Transit Local 1181, are on strike in New York City. Amalgamated Transit Union International President Larry Hanley.
We are the common victims of a mayor who is a billionaire and completely out of touch and out of control. He has picked this fight, staged it, brought it about on his calendar, not on any other schedule. He has an open fight with every worker who is employed by him right now in the city. He is refusing to negotiate contracts with cops and firemen and sanitation workers and teachers. The people are the victims, and they should stand with us and tell this mayor to just cut it out and start being a mayor and stop being a billionaire.
The union says after 50 years of job protections and wage stability for school bus drivers, Mayor Bloomberg arbitrarily threw that out by putting school bus contracts up for bids among private companies. That means the workers could suddenly lose their jobs or have their wages and benefits lowered. The ATU tried to avert a strike over the issue, but Hanley says Bloomberg won't even talk to the union. Hanley says ATU school bus drivers are committed to getting school children safely to and from school. He says safety is enhanced by job and wage stability among drivers because qualified, experienced drivers stay on the job longer. Hanley says the people of New York and the union bus drivers are victims of a right-wing attack on working people.
This is Wisconsin and Michigan having come to New York City. It is a mayor who was on the same right-wing agenda, although sometimes he hides it, that Scott Walker has been on in Wisconsin. This is the right-wing Tea Party attack on working people, and people in this country really need to take stock of what's happening and stand up with organized labor in New York as they have stood with organized labor around the country.
French auto workers near Paris have occupied a plant to protest layoffs. Jesse Russell reports.
Peugeot Citroën workers near Paris have occupied a plant in protest of planned layoffs. The company is in the process of laying off 8,000 workers and closing that plant. According to a union representing the workers, nearly 300 have stopped production at the plant, bringing work practically to a standstill. There are roughly 3,000 employees at the plant, but the majority of the striking workers are on the production line. Europe hasn't shared in North America's rebound of the auto industry. The European Union saw new car registrations drop by 16% at the end of 2012. The union has been seeking early retirement offers for the workers who are over the age of 55. But so far, the company has been unwilling to offer such incentives. Peugeot's competitor, Renault, is also planning layoffs, but they're doing so by offering early retirement plans and not bringing on new hires.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, in a right-to-work state, at a low cost, with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? Time to let these people learn the lesson.
You know, I want to...
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can give me a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, I've often joked that I'd like to outsource my job. I'd like to have someone come in, do my work for me so I could sit back and, you know, I used to joke about it a lot when I used to work on the dock loading trucks for a living. Now you found one guy making upper six figures, making tons of money, decided that, well, you know what, I'll just outsource my job to China. In fact, had a couple of third-party contractors doing his job from Shanghai. And evidently it took the company, well, quite a while to find out, what was going on and, you know, and it was really a computer thing where they found this and they thought, uh-oh, we got a computer, the Chinese are breaking into our company. It turns out that, you know, this guy had just hired three other people in China to do his job. Now, understand, he's making a couple hundred grand a year, paying, you know, maybe pennies to them, sitting around doing, well, what? Well, when they went back and they looked at his browsing history, they compiled a typical day of work, according to the folks at the Business Insider. And his typical day of work was 9 a.m., show up, surf Reddit for a couple hours, and watch cat videos. 11:30, go to lunch. 1 o'clock was eBay time. 2 o'clock was Facebook updates, LinkedIn, that stuff. 4:30, end of the day to update email to management. And then at 5 o'clock, go home. He was sitting back watching videos, making several hundred thousand dollars a year. And the upper ups, the higher offices, not happy about that because screw him. That's their job to do nothing and outsource all the work so they make tons of money. So I would assume he has been canned. An interesting study or an interesting survey over at the Business Insider. The poll is, and I love how people write these polls to get predictable outcomes. The folks at the Business Insider, their poll reads like this. The Business Roundtable wants to raise the retirement age to 70, claiming it'll save billions in Social Security and Medicare spending. Is this a good idea? So your three choices then become, yes, it's a good idea. Employees shouldn't be allowed to work past, should be allowed to work past current retirement age. They should be allowed because, hey, you know, they should, right? Because like Pat Robertson said.
We should push that retirement age out to 70 or 72. And it's not going to hurt anybody because people really like to work. They don't want to sit around. There's nothing worse than sitting on a rocking chair rusting out. Who needs that?
Yeah, who needs that? And no, the current retirement age is fine, and there are better ways to fix the system. Well, obviously the rational people said there are better ways to raise to fix the system than raising the retirement age. But the second answer, 33% of the people who took the poll, employees should be allowed to work past the current retirement age. Like you don't have that ability now. Like there aren't, like the woman who served me the other day at the restaurant who was 73 years old. She had a choice. Oh no. Her choice? Starve. Because the Social Security, not cutting it. Didn't have a pension. Worked low wage jobs her whole life. She's got to work until she dies. And that's the world that they want to take us to. Because, you know, as I said, you know, you've got these folks at the Business Roundtable, as the poll said. You know, the CEO union, that's what I call them. The Business Roundtable is basically a union of CEOs. They represent the CEOs. You know, your big bankers, your big conglomerate retailers, the huge insurance companies, all of them. They want that retirement age up to 70 at least. Because they say, well, you know, those Social Security benefits, they're just so generous. Ask the woman 73 working at the diner if they're generous. Ask any retiree who's been retired for 4 or 5 years, who's seen their Social Security eaten away by inflation, if they're too generous. What I find ironic. Much like when we talked with Larry Hanley a little bit ago in the program, where Mayor Bloomberg is saying it's irrational to pay this much money for school kids to get to school. You know, paying those bus drivers $30,000, $40,000. It's irrational to be paying that kind of money. We should be paying them, I guess, minimum wage is where they want to go. And if they could get them to do it for free, maybe hire prison labor. There's an idea. But you look at this and you go, you know, this is where they want to take us. And I'm saying, you know, at some point, don't we have to go, no, it's a bad idea. It's another in a long line of bad ideas. So think this through for a second. You go back to the fiscal mirage, the big cliff. You go back to that. You come to this, to the debt ceiling talk. It's all around, we need to cut entitlements. We need to cut things for those people. We need to cut things for those workers, the rabble, the people who are at the margin. We need to go after them first. If you remember the whole campaign that Romney and Ryan ran on, you know, those 47% of people who don't pay federal taxes. You know, those 47% of low-wage workers, you know, the people who serve you your food or clean your house or take care of your grandparents and take care of your kids before they go to school. Because, you know, those preschool programs, that early childhood education, we don't really take serious in this country. You know, those low-wage workers, those are the people who are the 47%. Those people who work at Walmart. Those people who don't pay federal income tax. Why? Because they don't make enough money to pay federal income tax. And what did you hear during the campaign? They need to pay more. And what are we hearing now? We need to get them to have skin in the game. Love that one too. Real good, rich, visual. It's BS. It's a ripoff. We're getting screwed. And we're going to get screwed even more. And as I was looking through the Business Insider website, I saw this headline. There's growing talk that the debt ceiling is no longer the biggest threat to the U.S. economy. Really? Do you think? Gee, I think I've been saying for, since the end of 2008 that our biggest problem is we're losing jobs. We need more jobs. Yes. And you know what kind of jobs? Jobs that don't pay minimum wage. Jobs that pay above minimum wage, way above minimum wage. And maybe if we need to, take it from the corner offices. And yes, my Tea Party friends. Yes, my Tea Twizzlers. It is redistribution of wealth. Distributing it back to the way it was when we had a growing middle class. When we had a middle class that, oh, I don't know, could afford to take a vacation every once in a while. Could afford to send their kids to college without saddling them with a generation of debt. Just a thought. And you go back and you think about this debt ceiling thing. And we talked about it last night. The World Bank saying, hey, you better get your stuff in order because you're gonna kill the entire globe. In fact, you'll probably end up knocking Europe back into a not just a triple debt recession, a triple dip recession, but a quadruple. And Fitch Ratings coming out and saying, look, you know, hey, if things don't get done, you're going to see a downgrade regardless if you come up with a deal. Because they're saying, look, you know, the negative outlook on your rating is, look, it's going to happen. Even if you avert the crisis, you got to get something done soon. And it's all this appearance that, well, we're not rational. We're not paying our bills. We're not even on the same page. And there's a lot of call right now. There are a lot of people saying, well, you know what? We need to get rid of that debt ceiling thing. It's not doing what it was supposed to do. And look, it is unnecessary. And the reason I say it's unnecessary is it's money we've already spent. So the time to argue about the spending was just when you spent it, right? Duh. I know in the Smith household, if we're going to use kitchen table economics, which the right loves to do, even though the way government operates is not like the Smith family operates, nor should it be. But if you're going to have to use an analogy, before I spend money, I go, is this something I need? That's when you have the conversation. You don't get home and go, you know, I've used it for a couple of weeks. Do I really need it? No, I'm not going to pay for it. Do you think you'd get away with that? Well, that's what they're trying to do. And now you've got the Treasury Department not putting money into the pension funds of the government workers, which is causing another problem. And what are the Republicans doing? Well, they ran off for their little retreat, little kumbaya moment. Now they're saying, well, what we need is, well, we need to have a shorter term debt limit increase, just for the short term. Paul Ryan at the Kings Mill Resort in Williamsburg was asked by reporters, well, you know, the worst thing for the economy is for this Congress and the administration to do nothing to get our debts and our deficits under control, he said. We think the worst thing for the economy is to move past these events that are occurring with no progress on the debt and the deficits. So, maybe a shorter term deal. And I look at it a little differently. I look at it as another opportunity to hold the country hostage. Another chance for them to, well, gin up this kind of fervor. And to gridlock things. Because what really is angering to me is the things that I think are important are being lost in all of this stuff. You know, while we're spending a lot of time talking about the debt ceiling or the fiscal cliff, we've still got problems with what, one in four kids living in poverty? 1 in 6 people in poverty? We've still got millions of people without work. We've got a crumbling infrastructure. We've got, 50, 60 million people without health care. 100 million people underinsured. We've got serious problems. And yet we've allowed ourselves to be mired in gridlock. And this is where, you know, I go back to the gerrymandering. The Republicans are in control of the House for one reason and one reason only. 2010 was their year. And with the census and all of that coming around, they were able to gerrymander. They were able to, well, make districts, and there are some very creative-looking drawings, so that they could hold on to power. That's the only reason. It's the only reason they didn't get swept away again. And they're going to hold all of us hostage because of it. Because they have to have their pound of flesh. They have to have their carve-up. You, me, the rest of us, you be damned. Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
In the scramble to fix the federal deficit, one of Washington's worst ideas is widely considered by political elites, including some Democrats, to be a good idea, even a painless fix. The idea is to raise the age of eligibility for both Social Security and Medicare, shoving it from 65 to 67 or beyond. After all, goes Washington's conventional wisdom, people live so much longer now, so it won't hurt to postpone eligibility and save a couple of years of taxpayer outlays to people. But, as economist and columnist Paul Krugman has pointed out, this bit of conventional wisdom is merely conventional, in the sense of trite. While life expectancy has gone up on average, it has not increased much for working stiffs, especially tens of millions of lower wage and poorer workers. Unlike being a member of Congress, the work that these people do tends to require heavy lifting, which can make you old fast. Requiring them to do it even deeper into old age and to wait longer for medical assistance is, as Krugman bluntly calls it, cruel. Bear in mind, too, that working-class families are precisely the people who count on Social Security and Medicare. They don't have the socialized medical benefits and golden pensions that those pampered conventional wisdom spouters in Congress get. Oh, one more thing. The purported savings from this fix are so minimal as to be illusory. In fact, shoving ill or crippled elderly workers out of the cost-effective Medicare system will jack up America's health care costs. This is Jim Hightower saying, so raising the retirement age is gratuitous as well as cruel, but mostly it's severely ignorant. What's at work here is a policy-making elite that includes no working-class people, so it can cluelessly believe that making the lives of these Americans worse is painless.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Well, if he won't go home, put a hat on him. Put a hat on him. That's what they've done in Los Angeles County. You remember last year there was all of the scare over HIV in the adult industry? Well, Los Angeles County passed a law requiring porn actors to put a little hat on their Jimmy or on their little Willie. They're not happy about it. Today at the annual Adult Entertainment Expo, you had leaders from the big companies, Wicked Pictures and Adam and Eve and Hustler and all them saying that, well, you know, the rest of the film industry, if they can do that to us, they're going to do it to you. It's the same anti-regulation argument going on. I don't care one way or another, to be honest, but I found it interesting that one of the people who was womaning one of the booths, you know, extolling the dangers of Measure B, because that was what they called it in Los Angeles County, Measure B. I love the article that said one actress who declined to be named because she worried her opinion might infuriate her boss confessed that while she would prefer to have her co-stars wear condoms when they were filming sex scenes, she didn't want the government telling me that has to happen. That's really not cool, she said. And I thought about this, and I'm going, well, she would prefer that they did, but the government's mandating it, so she would prefer they did. The government's saying you have to, but the company would say he can't. So, as if I'm getting this right, she would prefer that the industry tell her she can't. Corporate control is fine, but government saying, hey, we have the public interest at heart, probably should. Because there have been a number of outbreaks in the adult entertainment industry, you know, there was a big syphilis outbreak at one point. And then the HIV scare. Now, I just find it very, very interesting. And speaking of putting a hat on your gun, you know, I look at this NRA idea of putting more policemen in schools. And, you know, I was looking at this and you look at the number of schools that already have armed guards. And I was talking to a friend of mine who said that the high school that I went to now has police in the aisles, in the hallways. And you go, really? That's pretty weird, because the high school I went to was a, you know, pretty solidly white middle class school. You know, the worst crimes they had in that little place were, you know, some eggings or, you know, stuff like that. They got policemen now in the thing. And there was a report here released recently that pointed out that while looking at having all of these cops in these classrooms, what you've seen is a massive increase in the number of arrests that are going on in these school districts. In fact, it looked at one school in Mississippi that 33 of every 1,000 children were arrested and referred to juvenile detention centers. And you go through and you look at the number of these scenarios where having these cops and having these people in these schools cracking down on fairly minor offenses are being arrested. And you go, I seem to remember just up the road here and up near Scranton, you had the two judges who were ordering kids to kid prison because there's a profit margin. And you stop and you think about all this and you go, in the big picture, when you look at this idea that the NRA has thrown out there, that some people are going and going, oh, it's not a bad idea. We should have a cop in every classroom. This is a huge boom for the security complex, for the, well, call it what it is, the control complex. I mean, I hate going to public events. I hate going through to concerts. I hate going to airports, because everywhere you go, you're being searched. Are we making the next generation used to it? And I have a friend who grew up in the UK, and she said, you know, hey, get used to it, because it's what we've been doing for years. Every time you go to a nightclub, you're opening up your coat, you're opening up your wallet, your purse, everything. You're being searched everywhere you go. Is that where we're heading? Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day. Do I want my kids going to school having their lunchboxes searched, having them patted down just to get into the doors of the school? So that we got to protect those gun rights. Got to have those 100 clips. Got to have those clips with 100 bullets. They got to have that assault weapon. Got to have those. Everybody else be damned. Interesting. And the more we look at this, I'm hoping at some point We shake ourselves awake. Because for me, it's a profit motive. I look at the profit motive. I look at the idea behind it, and there's big money. There's big money in this stuff now. Bloomberg News had a story today. Caught my attention. U.S. corporations, they write, after-tax profits, well, they've grown 171% under Obama. More than any president since World War II. So I listened to the right talk about, well, you know, Obama's anti-business. You know that. Of course he is. He's anti-business. Hates business. Hates capitalism. Hates the free market. Hates free enterprise. Hates them all. And you go, 171% increase in profits? Under his watch, the guy who's a socialist, communist, fascist, whatever, istist. They go on to write that they are now at their highest level relative to the size of the economy since the government began keeping records in 1947. Profits, they write, are more than twice as high as their peak during Ronald Reagan's administration and more than 50% greater during the late 1990s internet boom. Even the profits are even higher than they were during the golden years of the Clinton administration. Now you compare that to both Bush administrations and, well, not even on the charts. Because during both Bush presidencies, profit growth declined. Bad policies. Here's the problem. 171% growth in profits for corporations under Obama. How'd that happen? Well, I mean, you had the big comeback because of the Bush years, because we had collapsed. That's a portion of it. But the reality is you've got wages right now, as a percentage of our economy, lower than they've ever been. So profits never higher, wages never lower. Explain that to me. Do we see the cause and the effect? If I'm bringing home less money, if all of us are bringing home less money, if you see what's going on in New York with the school bus drivers, I mean, it's apparent. I mean, and they're not even trying to hide it. We want to screw these workers out of wages. We want to cut their pay. And we're surprised that they went on strike because we backed them into a corner? Are you kidding me? I say we should all be doing what those workers, what those bus drivers are doing. I say we should all be doing what the teachers in Chicago did. Saying enough already. We have sacrificed. We have sacrificed mightily. Because after all, profits never better. Wages never lower. And I bring this back to the reality that what's happened over the last 30 years, and this is all very predictable, it's all right down the line. You destroy a worker's ability to collectively bargain. You would destroy their ability to say, hey, I want some of that profit. And guess what happens? Wages never lower. Profits never higher. Common sense. The less ability that we have to bargain, the weaker our labor laws, and the more they're able to divide us and pit us against each other, this is what we end up with. So while they're dangling the shiny thing in our face, and while they're saying, oh, it's abortion, or it's gay marriage, and oh, they're going to take your guns, we're completely distracted. Detached from the reality that we are getting screwed. And the sad reality is it's my kids' generation, they're the ones who are really going to get it. Because there's not much farther down to go. You know, I go back and I think about my grandparents quite often. Their generation was remarkable in a number of ways. One, they grew the largest middle class in the history of civilization, in the history of the planet. And how'd they do that? By sticking together. What are we here today? Oh, we're individuals. Look out for number one. Hooray for me. How'd they do it? They voted for politicians who, like them, wanted a strong middle class, understood that if you pay someone a decent wage for a decent day's work, it was going to benefit the economy as a whole. 171% increase growth in profits under the Obama year? Are you kidding me? And they're saying he's anti-business? He's in the pockets of organized labor. You know how many times I've heard that? Well, Obama's just a union stooge. Heard that a bunch. I'm sorry. I'm not seeing that. When you're looking at profits, I mean, I can't say this enough. Profits have never been higher. Wages, never lower. How much longer are we going to put up with it? I hope not much. My kids are depending on us not. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
Important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
You know, you look at all these stories about the Sandy Hook conspiracy theorists. You know, really? I mean, don't we have enough conspiracy theories? I mean, you look at the Obama was born in, where was it? Kenya? He's not a citizen. His birth certificate's a forgery. All this stuff. Well, there's a new study out from the folks at Farley Dickinson University who claim that birthers are far more numerous than anyone ever thought. In fact, they claim, according to their polling, 64% of Republicans believe it's probably true that Obama is hiding something about his personal past, including his birth certificate. They also polled on the conspiracy theories of 9/11, that Bush stole the election of 2004, see, you know, 2000 they didn't get into, but 2004, and Obama stole the election of 2012. 75% of Republicans polled believed at least one of the conspiracy theories, while Democrats, 56% believed at least one. You know, I had a guy the other day tell me Obama stole this last election, and he did it with a straight face. I was like, gotta give him credit. Good for you. This will make the right wing very happy, especially my religious friends. Did you know So Help Me God isn't really constitutional, and it's not part of the official presidential oath? Yeah. Chester A. Arthur, the first president to utter the words during the inaugural oath. My history major producer didn't even know who Chester A. Arthur was. Let's go to Washington, D.C. Talk Radio News Service, Justin Duckham. Justin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, great to be here.
Can you believe a guy with a history major not knowing who Chester A. Arthur is?
You know what? I was actually a history major as well, and I don't really have much of a background with Chester A. Arthur either.
All I know is he was the 25th president. That's it.
Whoops, that's more than a lot of people know. That's back more than I know off the top of my head.
Back in the 1880s. Anyway, but yeah, I was surprised. I was surprised to know that that isn't part of the official oath. It was uttered by Arthur.
No, it is pretty interesting. You know, it's sort of like, I guess, one of those In God We Trust things, which wasn't really on money until the 50s or in the, Pledge of Allegiance.
Until yeah, good point. Good point. So what's going on in the world? I see that... The Republicans ran away to their little retreat, going to have their little banging on drums and dancing around naked little retreat. Some news out of there, though.
Yes, there was some news, and not just the fact that they had a briefing on, dealing with minority outreach that took place in a room named after a plantation, but we had some real news. We had House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan coming out and telling reporters that the GOP was talking behind closed doors about the possibility of passing a short-term debt limit deal in order to add on some more spending cuts, which the administration has avoided. Of course, this is something that the White House is not really looking forward to. They want a full, clean, raised limit in order to avoid, a credit downgrade like we saw in 2011. But at least it shows that the entirety of the House caucus is not really interested in driving the country off the cliff as fast as... initially believed.
Well, I think the Republicans are waking up to the reality that, the majority of people don't see the world the way they do. And, I talked a little bit earlier about the Fitch ratings thing that came out on Tuesday. The fact is even if we do at some point raise that debt ceiling, they're claiming we're probably going to end up with a downgrade anyway because we're so irrational that you can't get things done.
I know. This is, easily one of the, another one of the dozens of end-of-the-world scenarios that this Congress has had, starting with the 112th, where about every 3 months or so it looks like, there's going to be complete and utter disaster. And that's just sort of become the new norm in Washington. Every month or so it looks like, this is the end and that Republicans are never going to yield and that all is doomed. And, the markets have, or at least will start probably taking note.
I mean, you're talking about an institution, a valued institution in our nation that has an approval rating of about as high as cockroaches.
No, that is true. Historically, though, in recent years, Congress has never gotten that high, but they certainly have hit a new low this time, as Gallup and some other polling agencies have noted.
Yeah, I mean, you look at this and this idea, and I knew this was coming. Oh, we'll do a short-term deal so that we can keep having these fights and keep getting people all lathered up, and I guess a lot of it has to do with fundraising, but I believe a big part of it is turning people away from the process, and that benefits Republicans. I truly believe that if they turn enough, working-class people who just say, they're all crooks, they're all bums, and they stay home on Election Day, it only benefits them.
Well, that is a pretty genius move, and if that's their goal at the end of the day, they're doing a pretty good job of it.
I don't know if it's the goal, but, I mean, it's the end result of all of this.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember talking to somebody in Wisconsin about during the whole everything that was going on around Walker taking collective bargaining rights away and the battle there, and they said, at the end of the recall, I didn't care. I just wanted it to stop. I wanted the constant berating and the constant ads and the robocalls and the mail just to stop. And I think we're getting to that point where people are just going, I just want it to stop. Just do your jobs already.
I mean, that's exactly how a lot of Americans are feeling, There is sort of a false equivalency to this that has it to it extending to both parties. But at the end of the day, there really does seem to be some kind of a post-partisan desire among a lot of the American electorate.
So what kind of responses are you getting on yesterday on the big gun announcement that the president and Joe Biden came up with?
Well, it's pretty interesting. A lot of Republicans aren't really as threatened by it as, you'd expect them to be. We've seen some pretty prominent voices coming out saying that these executive orders don't really actually amount to a hill of beans. We also saw on the kind of legislative side of things, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid saying that he was not going to take up anything unless it could pass through the House, which, you know, actually kind of gave him some political cover since he comes from a relatively shaky district that's, you know, pretty gun heavy.
Well, he's got a lifetime rating of a B with the NRA. So, you know, he's not out of step with a lot of the NRA's goals.
Exactly. You know, and we also saw Boehner coming out and saying that he was going to send the legislation when it comes in from the White House to the relevant committees. So there's not much of a move there, but it's still going to be an uphill fight. And today, Vice President Biden came out and spoke with the U.S. Conference of Mayors and said that this is going to be a fight that they're going to be focusing on. And he promised that the administration was going to be going through the halls of Congress and really trying to bring this home and really trying to do a full-force legislative push. So we're going to see that, of course, coming in the coming weeks once we see the official legislation unveiled.
Now, I got to be honest with you, though. I look at this and I wish they would spend this much energy and this much verbiage on getting funding for mental health services, on combating poverty, you know, getting people jobs, getting our economy. I just kind of wish that we were moving in that direction, because I think a lot of our societal ills go away when you have a growing middle class, when you have people who have jobs that they can support their families and, oh, I don't know, have a little disposable income to do other things with.
You know, that's true, but at the same time, we saw the administration try to, you know, make a pretty hefty case when it came to jobs. We saw the president come out and give his big jobs plan speech that sort of substituted as a State of the Union light. You know, I wouldn't say it's fair to say that they haven't really tried to push that issue, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's kind of hard when you have a do-nothing Congress. And I think at this time, there's some hope that maybe they could get some action, so it's at least worth pursuing. But, you know, I do agree at the end of the day, though, that there are a lot of issues that, you know, people would like to see tackled first.
Yeah. What did you think of Chris Christie's statement on the NRA ad?
From what you were talking about earlier about the desire for Americans just to kind of move beyond politics and go straight down to it, I think Christie has been trying to hone that image. You know, I don't think it actually stands
that
up
image.
To scrutiny.
Yeah, that image.
Image, yes. you know, when it comes to scrutiny, you know, it's obvious that Chris Christie's kind of a jerk, but you know, he came out today and once again broke ranks with his parties and publicly denounced the NRA ad, saying that it was reprehensible, and really went after it, saying that it was inappropriate for them to attack the daughters, considering that you know, the Obamas haven't had a choice over whether or not they were given Secret Service protection. You know, I think a lot of this was made with 2016 in mind, and I think it's just sort of a new thing that Christie found to really kind of stoke up his own favorability rating within the state.
Yeah, he didn't have anything to say about the ad itself, as I remember. It was just that it was reprehensible. Not that the NRA has completely gone off the beaten path, and even further away from where they were just back in 1999. I mean, in the ad, they talk about opportunity zones, free gun-free zones for you. But not for his kids. But in 99, after the Columbine shooting, they were all in support of gun-free zones. They come out against the gun show loophole. Back in 99, all in favor of it. So, I mean, just in a short period of time, you've seen a complete 180 by this group.
I mean, yes, they have. And it's not really that surprising, considering that this is a giant, massive organization. And at the end of the day, it's comprised of people who are paid, you know, from what I can tell, very well. Just to ensure that, you know, guns are protected at all costs and that these certain things, you know, are not touched. And at the end of the day, they don't really have, you know, constituents. They don't really need to necessarily be honest with people. They have a sort of business-like mission, and that's something that they're pursuing. So it's, you know, pretty much about as heartless and weird as I would expect to see from any K Street institution.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, you know, I have friends who are members of the NRA, and they actually think that the NRA represents them. I mean, and that's kind of, I guess it's, you're a member of an organization and kind of clueless of its mission. Because as I understand the NRA, they're just a front group for the industry. Not for the you know, the gun owners so much, but the industry.
Exactly. You know, it is kind of a clever move. They are a lobby at the end of the day. It's not necessarily social club. It's not really a lifestyle thing. And I think a lot of the people who are really the public face of that, you know that deep down, and are, you know, just sort of dedicated to having these people who pay these kind of exorbitant rates for lifetime membership and don't necessarily think about, you know, more of the fact that, you know, is this really a group that has my interests at heart, or you know, are there somebody who is just kind of a public, you know, front for a pretty huge industry?
A massive industry. You know, since the day Obama was elected, all I've been hearing from my NRA friends is Obama's going to raise the price of guns, he's going to raise the price of bullets, oh, he's going to come personally knock on your door and steal your gun. I'm going, none of that stuff has happened. Yet, it's still out there. Why? Because it's profitable. And I just saw a story today, Pennsylvania, gun sales are up. Why? They've sufficiently scared the hell out of people.
Exactly, you know, and, you know, there are even the gun show ads. I remember, you know, I used to kind of pick those out, and they would pretty much frequently in the ad state that Obama was coming for your gun, so come on down now. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's a pretty brilliant marketing strategy.
Yeah, I mean, you're people all worried and scared. And you know, I was just reading a thing yesterday about these gun shows. Where the gun shows don't let you bring guns to the gun show. You can't bring your gun to the gun show. And in fact, I guess it was yesterday on C-SPAN that Bob Godlet was asked about why the RNC didn't allow people to bring in concealed guns. And, well, we want to make sure everybody's safe.
That is, you know, interesting. You know, I'm sure there are plenty of situations where Republicans would not necessarily back up their, you know, Second Amendment ways when it came to their, to her own backyard.
Yeah, good point. Lastly, I see the Algerian government has completed military operations. What happened?
Well, it looks like there was an airstrike that was carried out on a gas field after it was seized by Islamic militants who were acting in retaliation for the French intervention in Mali. It looks like there may have been casualties, around 10 or so. There were 10 Americans there, 5 of which have already escaped. But overall, it looks like a lot of hostages were released and that this was a relatively fruitful mission. However, the U.S. is still waiting to hear from the Algerian government for the full story. Carney said today that they are still kind of waiting for the complete picture. And, you know, this is going to be a story that's going to be coming in, you know, coming days. And it looks like it may be the start of a pretty big trend in the region of, you know, enhanced Islamic attacks or Islamist attacks and whatnot.
Correct. Just what we need. Oh, Justin, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Hey, you have a good one. I'll see you at the inauguration.
Will do. Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
Earth, sky.
Just like you or me, Earth casts a shadow. Earth's shadow extends into space in the direction opposite the sun.
There are several good times to think about and be aware of Earth's shadow. For example, you can see Earth's shadow any evening ascending in the east. It ascends at the same rate that the sun is setting below the western horizon. The shadow is a deep blue-gray, and it's darker than the blue of the twilight sky. The pink band above the shadow is called the Belt of Venus. And just so you'll recognize it, remember that the shadow is curved in just the same way that the whole Earth is curved.
You can also see Earth's shadow during an eclipse of the moon. Earth's shadow extends so far into space that it can touch the moon. That's what a lunar eclipse is. It's the moon within Earth's shadow. During a lunar eclipse, a small amount of light from the sun filters through our planet's atmosphere onto Earth's shadow on the moon. That's why, at the middle part of a total lunar eclipse, the shadow on the moon looks reddish.
There's a third time to think about seeing Earth's shadow, and that is, night is a shadow. When night falls, you're standing within the shadow of Earth. So check out Earth's shadow, in the east just after sunset, brushing the moon's face during a lunar eclipse. Or think about it when you're standing outside in darkness after sunset. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
And you know, the sandwich guy said, you touch this, touch this, touch this, go pay the cashier, there's your sandwich. It's amazing.
Oh, ho, ho, it's magic.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can get the podcast right there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If anything I said got your attention under your nerves, whatever. So help me God, thanks to Chester A. Arthur. I always thought that was one of those things that you hear from people, I'll get back at you, so help me God. And I always thought, that's where it came from. These politicians, we'll get back at you for making me go through this. Interesting, though, the whole so help me God thing, one nation under God thing, all of that. You've got people who do really bizarre things in the name of God, don't they? And I do believe, we all under the same sky, under the same idea. But you got people who do really bizarre things, like this Huntsville, Alabama woman who decided it'd be a good idea to take holy water and put it in a spray bottle and go around spraying people that, were at a pro-choice rally. Just, she was not happy with what was going on, decided she was going to go out and, spray holy water all over everyone. And I guess that's not quite as bad as the Texas woman who decided that, God told her to light her apartment on fire. And I guess, the more I think about it, God tells some people very, very strange things to do. And, I was thinking about this whole mental health thing. And look, I go to church and have for years and do all of that stuff. I believe in God, all of that. But it's those folks who are on the extreme who are the ones who are spraying people with holy water because God told them to do it. The kind of people that would light their apartment on fire because God told them to do it. The more people profess, the more they, they proclaim their piety. Those are the folks I tend to look out for the most. Those, and maybe that should be a line on the gun application. Just a thought. Interesting story from the Morning Call. One of those where you go, who starts the fires. When I used to live in Allentown, I worked up in Tannersville. Up there, they had a whole bunch of volunteer fire departments. And it's extreme anything that scares me. I understand that. Anytime you have someone who takes anything to the extreme, that worries me. But up there, they had some fires, and it turns out, it was a couple of different these volunteer firefighters. Well, this guy in near Reading, Hamburg, actually, evidently, this guy back in 2008 set a fire to his neighbor's house and garage. Caused about $150,000 worth of damage. And got away with it. It was back in 2008. Nobody knew who it was. The police were perplexed. They did their investigation. They couldn't find anything. Didn't know. Turns out, he went to apply for a job in Virginia. Not a volunteer, but an actual paid job as in, in Virginia, Fairfax County, Virginia. And during the interview process, he admitted, and I don't know if he admitted it or said, or boasted it. So it depends on how you look at it. But he admitted that he had set the fire back in 2008. And you go, why would you bring that up? You got away with it. And I know people, I've had friends who, they've gone through the whole police background check and they have to take lie detector tests. And I wonder if it's the same thing where he goes, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to get caught on the lie detector test because I really want this job. So now I'll admit to arson. That'll help. Yeah. He was charged with arson on $25,000 bail. So good. You got to, I always go back to what my grandfather said. Again, it's one of those things that sticks with me. If you've done something wrong, make sure you're the only one who knows it, because then you got about a 50% chance of not getting ratted out. And this is a perfect example of that. Didn't tell anybody. And still got ratted out. Some good news out in West Virginia. One of the former superintendent at the Upper Big Branch Mine, where the 29 miners died in 2010, well, he's been sentenced to almost 2 years in prison on federal conspiracy charges. The guy's name's Gary May. He's been sentenced, not that he's going to serve it, sentenced to 21 months and fined $20,000 in court, in the federal court in Beckley, West Virginia today. To me, I look at this and I go, okay, good. Somebody's held accountable. Somebody's going to go to jail. But he was, again, just one of those people following orders. The guy at the top, the guy who set this all in motion, this whole push for more profit over people, this has got to stop. So a guy's going to get 21 months in jail. He was one of the medium fish on the scale. But the big fish keep getting away. Something's seriously wrong with that. Another longtime Massey Energy exec. He's accused of two federal counts of conspiracy. Evidently, there's some plea hearing set up. So we'll see what happens there. I'm still waiting for the big fish to fry. I would still like to see Blankenship go. Because at the end of the day, I read those memos. Our job is to run coal. Yeah. Real quick, another reason to stay home when you're sick. The flu is they're saying, epidemic levels. We've got to be very cautious. Another reason to stay home while you're sick. Evidently, in New Hampshire, they have passed a law beginning here at the beginning of 2013 that bans driving under the influence of not just illegal drugs, but of NyQuil. So if you've got Sudafed or if you've got NyQuil or even, they say, ibuprofen, they claim it could harm your mental status and you could be charged with driving under the influence, which is why I think we need to have workers with paid sick days so that they don't have to go to work. They stay home, get better. And in fact, 79% of workers in the food industry and 90% of workers in the restaurant industry who have no sick days whatsoever, folks are saying now, yeah, majority of people, 57%, said that those people, they should have paid sick time. And you go, about time? Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, best place to get the podcast that you can listen to. Also, take it on the go with your smartphone, the Stitcher app. Tomorrow we will be back. More of the privatization schemes we're seeing rolled out before our very eyes. This whole push towards hacking off everything that is yours and mine, we've got to stop it. If it's not the lottery, it's the wine and spirit shops, it's not that, it will be everything else. There is nothing off their table, which is why we've got to stand together, stand tall, stand united, and we will fight back. We will win. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array.